WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Jolene.
Peter, I love how you just turned my mic on with a vengeance over there.
What do you mean?
You meant it when you hit that
bam
button.
Yeah. Because, boy, we haven't been on in a couple of weeks. And all things notwithstanding. Does that make any sense? We would do 52 shows a year because this is a weekly phone-in talk show. And WRIF, Angelina and I invite you to call in at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And give us your opinion on the stuff that is happening around the world or around the block.
Yes.
Yes. If you'd like to
email. We're never for a lack of stuff.
Yeah, stuff, man. Yeah.
Right.
You never, who was I listening to that was talking about this? That when people do things, pardon me, at any given point in history, they don't know they're making history.
That's such a simple yet poignant.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're making history every day and all this stuff that's going on and whether you're paying attention to it or not. If you're not paying attention to it, for instance, your kids or your grandkids or whoever will be reading. So, wow, man, back in 2013, do you realize that blah, 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 blah?
Yeah,
you know,
and you're, right.
And say, what were you doing, Granddad? I don't know. I was at the bar. Or I was, you know, smoking a bowl. I don't know. So it behooves us, not because we want to know we're part of history. We're always part of history. But rather because it would be good if we could have some effect on it. And sometimes it's pretty easy to think that it's tough, that no matter what we do, we're not going to have an effect because all of our fates are in the hands of the elite.
Yeah, it does feel awfully hopeless at times for a lot of people, which is why I think there's such a large segment of the population in the United States right now who just are going toward what they call the middle, which is, I can't deal with any of it.
Well, remember our old friend whose name I have forgotten, who was the Jim Hightower. Remember,
sure.
Jim Hightower?
That is an older broadcaster.
Right. And he has a book out that, because he was from Texas. In fact, he was
progressive as they come.
Yeah. And he was the Texas Commissioner of Agriculture before he became a talk show host.
He is a cool guy.
He's
real cool. We actually took over his nationally syndicated radio show.
That's right. No wonder the guy never gets a hold of me. Yeah, but he has a book out. Do you remember that? It said, there ain't nothing in the middle except dead armadillos and yellow stripes.
Yeah, I do
remember. Middle of the road. That's nothing in the middle of the road. I'm
except
sorry.
For, yeah.
Yeah.
And
yellow stripes and dead armadillos.
That says it all.
Yeah. So, on the other hand, people can take extremes to the extreme.
And no kidding.
On one hand, I'm not, pardon me, I'm not really against having extreme opinions because I have a lot of extreme opinions.
Yeah, because if you ever said you were, you would have a whole lot of emails and phone calls saying, come on, Peter.
Well, but here's a couple of things I have. One, I don't try to shove them down people's throats. And the other thing, even though I was thinking about the level of discourse, political discourse, and the kind of manner in which people are reviled. Now, I mean, it's one thing to call a politician a dope or, think about how we talked for 8 years about George W. Bush.
Hitler comparisons.
Yeah. And so I really don't.
Some monkey comparisons.
Yeah. And I don't really care if people do that to Barack Obama or to any other politician. But there's a
unless
level.
Unless it's racist.
Well, unless it's
That's
racist.
What we're, yeah. I mean, and oftentimes, what's going on right now, the fact that we have a black president, and amazingly enough, so many people can in this country can't deal with that fact. A lot of these comments and name-calling go along with racism, Peter. Let's be real.
But as we saw last November, the majority of people can.
Because
the Republicans took a real shellacking, although you'd never know it. I mean, they have no sense of reality, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I guess I was thinking in some ways, and, you know, this is probably just giving them great publicity. I always say we don't like to give people we don't like publicity.
We usually withhold names.
But I was thinking about Ted Nugent and how he was invited to the president's State of the Union speech, and he was the guest of, okay, gee, what a surprise, Texas Republican U.S. Representative Steve Stockman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, both of them were raised in Metro Detroit before both of them moved to Texas. And I didn't know this. Nugent, who lives in Texas, spends a lot of time in his swamp in Jackson County and in Lake County as well. I thought we were rid of him for good.
No, I guess he's still here.
Because remember,
I thought he was gone, too.
He moved to be near George Bush.
Crawford, Texas.
I mean, not just near,
in the same town.
Yeah, which I thought, good riddance to bad rubbish.
Said, enjoy Crawford.
So if we want to hear his music, that's all we got to hear. We don't have to hear him. Yeah,
the man can rock, okay?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Then when he starts talking is when he loses a lot of people.
But it's pretty interesting that, first off, that an elected official of the United States would invite someone to be at the State of the Union thing where President Obama spoke, when he was investigated by the Secret Service after making open threats against the life of the president who was giving the speech.
It was that whole, if Obama becomes president, I'm going to either do this, to jail, or...
No, that's not. He really
that was made, one of those.
He said he'll be either dead or in jail if during the election. But he also is currently on federal probation stemming from a 2012 plea agreement for illegal hunting, right?
Oh, yeah, that was the bear. He got one too many bear.
Or something. He'd been accused also by Courtney Love of having sex with her when she was 12 years old.
Wait. Whoa. Back up. What?
That's some reading here.
Well, and I'm the pop culture queen over here. I try to keep it fresh on this show in the pop culture world.
Anybody know? Or Ted, are you listening?
Oh, that's... I don't know.
Give us a shout on this one. That's what it says here. When Nugent was 28, and that was like, what, 40 years ago?
I don't know how old he is.
Probably 40 years ago or so. He also has openly proclaimed that the Southern traitors should have won the Civil War.
Oh my gosh!
Is the kind of guy. So he gets invited to that, and then all he has are these. Rather than having any sort of sense of decorum, he goes to the State of the Union speech and calls Obama the ultimate scam artist. But I suppose that's better than the Republican who stood up that one time and called him a liar.
Yeah,
right?
he stood up and said, "You lie!
You lie!" Yeah. Yeah, well, hey, I'm all set to apologize if I am wrong about Ted Nugent and Courtney Love.
Well, this is what we need to say. This has been allegedly
reported. This has been reported by rockrap.com.
Okay, so allegedly.
Allegedly.
We have to throw that in that happened. We're not saying if he did or he didn't. You're just reporting something that was in the news.
Right. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't do that.
I don't have an opinion on it one way or another.
All right. So, this one thing. Let's look at this for a second. Here's the big headlines on Monday. Pope's sudden resignation sends shockwaves through church. Well, I can understand that if the head of my church resigned and he was, you know, really...
Well, first of all, it's the Pope and one hasn't resigned since the 1400s.
I know, but why is this a headline story? Why isn't this, like, back on page 28 in the religion section?
I'll tell you why.
Go ahead.
Because the Vatican is one of the biggest businesses in the world. And all of the minions around the world love themselves some Pope. And, you know, he's copping out, in my opinion. That old Pope, remember? He was walking around hanging his head down practically on the ground. He went all the way until the end. Come on.
I don't know who the hell you're talking about.
Remember the Pope? Was it John Paul III or something?
I never pay any attention to those guys.
He couldn't even hold his head up anymore, and he was still poping.
But they were saying, Viva il Papa, which means hooray for the Pope.
Oh, hooray. Okay.
Hooray, or, you know, or life to the
Pope. Life, yeah.
But when the Pope, I don't know which one it was even, visited, I think it was the guy before the current guy. Who's the guy? Benedict is the current guy, right?
Yeah. And the one before.
Well, was Paul, John Paul or something?
He was the one who couldn't hold his head up anymore.
Okay. Isn't there some Argent tune about that? Hold your head up.
He needed to listen to that song.
But so he came to Hamtramck in, I don't know when, the early 80s, I believe.
Okay.
And so these people put out these T-shirts that said, Viva la Papa. And the reason they put la there was Papa, they wanted the definite article to agree with the final vowel, like you do in Spanish and Italian.
Okay, but isn't that like female?
Well, it also means the la papa means the potato.
Oh no!
Il papa means the Pope.
The Pope.
So they got these T-shirts that say, you know, hooray for the potato.
Hey, that's a collector's item there. If you have one of those.
So I don't know. I'm sure this made a big deal to the Catholics.
Yeah.
I still don't understand why in the world.
Well, the scary thing, Peter. Well, that's because you come from a different point of view, perhaps. I don't know. I can kind of see why it's a big deal.
Okay.
But now I hear some of the rumors about, I can't even remember where this guy was from that they might replace him with, is even more,
right wing?
Yeah. Than this one. And I remember when Benedict came in, we were like horrified by some of the.
Remember too, which of those, you know, like, was it, the Da Vinci Code? Or, no, it was the other one. Demons and,
I don't know, I don't watch those kind of
something, movies. It was Saints and Demons or something like that. It was about this guy that had, they were trying to find this bomb that was planted in the,
Vatican?
In the Vatican, yeah.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, who am I rooting for here? No, I'm only kidding.
Peter.
I'm only kidding.
Bite your tongue.
I did. You know, I was only kidding.
Of course I do.
So anyway, what do you think?
We do not promote violence on this.
No, not at all.
Program.
Not at all.
No, ever.
Not
we're peace-loving, tree-hugging hippies over here.
So I didn't do that. So the State of the Union speech. President Obama, again, great-sounding programs and visions and what have you. He called for broad new government efforts to create jobs. He says he's going to hike the minimum wage to $9 an hour and spend $1 billion.
Should be there already.
To boost the battered manufacturing sector, declaring the rubble of crisis has been cleared. Also wants to create a universal preschool for all of our kids. And so a big agenda. He mentioned gun control as well.
Well, and that was kind of a big part of the speech where, Gabby Giffords, the congressperson from Arizona who was shot in the head and miraculously survived, and a few of the other horrible stories due to gun violence, they were in the audience, or family members of people who were killed. And he's like, Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. Da-da-da deserves a vote.
Yeah, the kids in Woodstown.
Yeah, the kids, that was powerful.
But I would suspect that nothing on his agenda is going to get, not just the gun thing, but none of it probably.
In general, right.
Well, the only thing was, one of the things he did is he is promoting a resurgence in U.S. manufacturing. Did you see that? And the next day, he headed down to Asheville, North Carolina, and he went to this the site of this manufacturer from Canada and said these people could have been anywhere in the world, and they decided to come here to the United States because of the quality of our workers and what have you. So I'm looking at all this, and then I'm thinking, I'm kind of looking through this story like in the New York Times and all that, and he being the president, repeated this phrase about, he played up his proposed increase in the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour from 7 1/4 an hour. If you work full-time, he said, you shouldn't be in poverty. Although, if you work at $9 an hour, that comes out to be, what, $18,000 a year or something like that.
It's tough.
I think you're still going to be in poverty. Jeez. Yeah. And, but I started thinking.
Which is very dangerous. But
yeah.
Do tell.
And I wanted to see, is this a union shop? Because
the one that he went to.
Here is, you know, our unions spending hundreds of millions of dollars to keep out, understandably, to keep out Mitt Romney, who, part of the Republican platform was to destroy unions, which would even sink the standard of living of the average middle class and working class person more so.
It's their dream.
Yeah. The Republican dream.
Yes.
Right. So here, this is from the Daily Caller. President Obama warmly praised the North Carolina subsidiary of a Canadian auto parts company that is investing in a right-to-work state during his post-State of the Union campaign swing on Wednesday. He flew to Asheville and spoke at the Linamark Corporation, a Canadian-based auto parts factory, which has opposed union organizing efforts in Canada. I mean, this is incredible. The company also set up its new U.S. factory in North Carolina, which is a right-to-work state where unions have little political clout. Right-to-work doesn't have anything to do with a right-to-work. What it really is a sense for workers to
not unionize.
To not unionize, and if you are in a union situation, that they don't have to pay dues and they get all the benefits. It's the classic freeloader image that the Republicans say they're against.
Yeah, and for a lot of people don't understand what that is. It's pretty simple that it takes jobs away.
Sure.
And it hurts states in general in so many ways.
Now, is Obama just clueless or is he just awful? Because he noted that Linamar produces parts for Caterpillar, a company that is widely disliked by union leaders because the way it's smashed its workforce and driven down their health care.
For sure.
Yeah. Increased their health care payments, had to accept a freeze on pensions and wages, and Caterpillar's doing just fine. I mean, they just...
I mean, they would have been fine before, but now they're really fine.
Well, all of this that we've talked about so many times before in this broadcast is how income is distributed, how wealth is distributed. And there's X amount, and then people are going to negotiate in one way or another how that's all distributed. Now, the Republicans go nuts because they say, oh, you're talking about income redistribution. Well, yeah. When workers' wages are pressed downward, that's a redistribution of wealth. It goes to the top. It's a redistribution of income.
Yeah, but they don't see it that way.
No. That, let's see, at other events, Obama has lavishly praised auto unions and slammed the Republicans for not supporting unions. And no reporter had the temerity to ask the press secretary why he was supporting a non-union auto factory opening in a right-to-work state.
I would have if I had been there.
Yeah. In Canada, Linamar has defeated unions organizing campaigns by promoting a fear of unions and hiring new employees from the families of existing employees, said John Amon, an organizer for the Canadian Auto Workers, the CAW. The company's opposition to the union is visceral and aggressive, he said. I mean, this sounds like Walmart. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's what's happening. Now, is this how we're going to bring jobs back to the United States? And we've talked about this as well. Drive down the average wage in the manufacturing sector, and eventually companies will say, well, wait a minute. We're not paying men and women a decent middle-class wage anymore. We're not paying them $50,000 and $60,000 a year so they can live in a nice home and they can have maybe even a vacation place and send their kids to college and all that. It's back to the 1920s or the 1880s, and we're only going to be paying our workers that wonderful minimum wage of $9 an hour, and they can work at Linamar for that and make $18,000 a year. And all these manufacturers are saying, now, wait a minute, these Chinese workers and these Vietnamese workers, they're starting to demand more. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can manufacture things here in the United States and not have to pay the shipping costs.
Exactly. It's win-win for them, right?
It is indeed. So this, but this minimum wage, it's not just a matter of Barack Obama not meeting his campaign promises, both in his inaugural address and in this State of the Union speech. I mean, he posed a vision, a progressive vision, a liberal vision, something that understood the level of increasing poverty in this country and the disproportionate amount of wealth that exists and all of that, and then didn't act on any of it. He talked about peace, and then he's still continuing wars and all that. Because,
yeah.
And we're going...
The king of the drones, I mean, really.
We're going, wah, you know, he lied to us. Well, hey, folks, guess what his job category is? Politician.
I mean, for real.
Yeah. So what's missing here is us's, right? That's what it is. In fact, one of the talks, remember he was talking, it was about we, you know, we did this, and Republicans said, no, I built this. I own this. I, you know, it's some crapo Ayn Rand stuff. She has, you know, some book, what was it, is that Anthem or something?
I don't know.
It's a, you know, Rush is really into them. He's not the band.
What?
The band Rush is really into Ayn Rand. Some of her, some of their songs are like Anthem. That song, that Rush song.
Didn't know this.
And one of the songs, or one of the, her books, I mean, her books are such crap. I mean, they're so badly written and they're so stupid philosophically.
I won't even
and all
pick
that.
One up.
No, I know. I've tried to read them. I mean, but they sell jillions of books, every year. You know, people go, right, I'm being repressed. You
know? And that's why they read it, or they read it and then feel like they're being
repressed. The big book, Atlas Shrugged, was when all of these, the elites withdrew their genius from society. You know what I mean?
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, we know that's fiction because we would be so much better off if the guys running the economy would have withdrawn their genius, because their genius is what sunk the economy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the genius of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. We can never say that too many times.
Hey, and Bill Clinton didn't help things much.
He did some serious damage, yeah. Right. Now, I'm just talking about, first of all, well, Reaganomics, but war.
Yeah, and then Barack Obama talks about global warming and then acts like it doesn't even exist.
Not only does he do that, he takes it a step further and helps these, you know, coal companies.
Well, he's talking about clean coal, which is
that's an oxymoron.
An oxymoron.
And a bunch of crap.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But you know, there is demonstrations all over the country today, including one of thousands and thousands of people gathered in the National Mall in Washington and marched on the White House for a climate change rally that was aimed at pressuring President Obama to reject that Keystone XL
oil
sands
pipeline. Yeah, a friend of mine hopped on a bus this morning, she and her daughter. I was real proud.
So guess how the right wing has reported this rally? They were there on the coldest day of the year. Therefore, they're saying there's global warming and it was 16 degrees wind chill.
They don't understand the error of their ways.
They don't understand.
Whatsoever. They don't understand that is just the stupidest comment ever when it comes to global warming.
313.
Please. It angers me.
It does. You give the phone number then.
Okay, it's 313-298-9743. We even work with someone who always does that every winter.
What?
You know?
Oh, that says...
the short one?
Yeah, it says that it's, it's cold outside. How can there be global warming?
Where's your global warming now, Werby? Yeah.
Lori Wallach, who I've interviewed before, is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. She said, is the height of cynicism for President Obama to couple the worthy goal of rebuilding American manufacturing with a call for more of the same NAFTA-style trade deficit-boosting, job-killing FTAs, which are free trade agreements, especially the 11-nation TPP, which is Trans-Pacific Partnership. Since the implementation of these agreements, 50,000 U.S. manufacturing facilities have been shuttered, and we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs, fully one-quarter of the American industrial jobs that existed before these agreements. And the first one was it was a Republican bill that was signed by a Democratic president. That's what they call bipartisanship, to screw the middle class and to screw working people.
Clinton.
In general. Clinton, yeah. Yeah. Let's see. U.S. exports to countries that are not FTA partners has exceeded U.S. export growth to countries that are FTA partners by more than 44% over the last decade, which means that
explain that.
Well, and this is even maybe people go, like, what is this?
Well, I
the
think
U.S.
It
trade deficit, interesting what I almost said. It was $151 billion since the FTAs were implemented. Let me just tell you that having a trade deficit of $151 billion is not good. I mean, in other words,
Okay, that's brass tacks there.
How about this, too? John Schmidt, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, because once President Obama said, hey, we gotta raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, other countries have it like 12 bucks an hour, and it, you know.
And more. Isn't it?
I don't think, maybe. I think 12 in Germany, I think, is the highest.
Oh, okay.
But hey, come on, junior producers, get on there. we want to actually, I'm not going to bring up the other fact checking thing that I mentioned, which could be, hopefully, is not an error. I'll tell you later.
Okay.
But the highest minimum wage. Oh yeah, that's what we have. A phone screener and assistant producer for.
He's probably typing away to you.
Oh, he is.
And
yeah.
He is. And
all right. Angels
we weren't ignoring. We didn't have you up on the screen.
Angels and Demons was the thing where they had a terrorist was going to blow up.
Oh, okay.
And Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged sold more than 1.5 million copies in Obama's first term.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's kind of creepy. Yeah. And you know, John, who's taking your phone calls in the other room, by the way, we put him through such an interesting variety of subjects throughout a show, because before the show, I had him look up what cut the mustard means. So we're all over the place already.
Anyway, where were we? We're somewhere. The minimum wage. Well, the Republicans, since the Roosevelt administration passed the first minimum wage bill, every time they tried to add another dime to it, they screamed this was going to destroy the economy. It would just it would be obliterated because all the employers would just raise their prices.
Yeah.
That it would.
Did that happen? No.
No. That they would. Well, to some extent, but not.
How much was it when it first?
I'll bet you. Well, there you go, John. What was
John,
the first minute? I'll bet on 35 cents an hour.
Okay, because I'm wondering how many decades it took to creep up. I remember making, you know, when I was younger, it was like 365 or something like that. I remember.
You know, you mean back in the
prehistoric
the
era.
Early 70s.
Yeah.
The late.
Not the early 70s. That would have been child labor law there.
Yeah. But, none of that's happening. And, well, here, let me just read a little of this. This is John Schmidt, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He says that modest increases in the minimum wage have little impact on unemployment due to adjustments by employers and workers. He said this has all been studied before. The evidence is clear. Modest minimum wage increases don't have much impact on employment. Well, I guess he wants to say that twice. An increase to $9 per hour would be highly important for the workers getting it, but the idea that this would lead to less employment is just not supported by the evidence. But it's this, you know, Republican right-wing talking point that will go all over the board. You think about this, folks, Republican, and how can any working person support these people? They do everything they can muster.
To make money off of them.
To defend the corporations and their right not to be taxed and to do whatever the hell they want, pollute and what have you. And then when it comes to some poor working person getting a, you know, $1.75 raise or something like that,
that's a huge deal. Yeah. That's the end of their world. They're not going to make that $1.75 an hour themselves.
Congressional proposals to raise the minimum wage to above $10 per hour, or President Obama's call for a minimum wage of $9 per hour, says John Schmidt, are well within the range of historical increases and would still leave low-wage workers behind reasonably historical benchmarks based on cost of living or productivity mm-hmm. growth. Now, that's what's happened. There's been this enormous increase in productivity, but the wealth created, I mean, you're producing more, selling more, zero has gone to the people producing it. All of it has gone to the upper 1%. Let's see. 1938, first minimum wage law, 25 cents an hour and 44-hour work week ceiling. Also was the first ban on child labor. And you got to believe the Republicans fought it tooth and nail. They said if we pay our workers 25 cents an hour, it's going to bring on another depression. Nobody will hire, what have you. I mean, one of the things that happened and why.
They've been at it for a long time, haven't they?
Yeah. They're ceaseless. I mean, one of the things that these raises are good for the economy is that people of that level of income, of poverty wages, every dime they get, they spend.
Every dime. And they don't even have enough to stretch an entire
right.
month on that.
So what happens when this money goes to the rich? They just invest it in this big gambling house called the stock market, right?
There or somewhere offshore where
offshore.
They don't have to pay taxes on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's usually it, like Romney did. And that's why he wouldn't show his taxes.
Yes.
Remember all that? That's,
yeah.
That sounds like
remember
a long
that?
Time ago.
Who?
Then, yeah. Who? Yeah. Where are Mitt Romney and where is George W. Bush? But you know what? Let's Thank Gaia for small favors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I just want to get to this one more thing.
Okay.
The Center for Economic and Policy Research's Dean Baker, who I've also...
he's amazing.
Yeah.
CEPR.org, by the way.
The purchasing power of the minimum wage peaked in the late 1960s at $9.22 an hour in 2012 dollars. Now get that. You understand what that is? If you adjust what people were making as the minimum wage in the 1960s
compared to the cost of living,
it would be $9.22
wow.
today. That is almost $2 above the current level of $7.25 an hour. They also noted that the minimum wage has not kept pace with productivity increases over the last 44 years, as it did from 1947 to 1969, in a period of great economic growth. And the unemployment rate for the year 1969 averaged less than 4%. The link between productivity growth and minimum wage ended in the 1970s. But they say if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity growth, it would be $16.54 an hour.
Whoa.
So, you know what
at least 12, come on.
So, folks, you know what that means? You're getting looted. You know, particularly at those lower levels. It's a system based on looting. It's the wealthy, it's the elite, looting the classes below them. Wow.
And it's tough that that even minimum wage jobs are not the easiest to get right now because everyone's trying to get jobs.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to take a break, but Mike and Maurice and Mike also, second Mike, hang on. We'll get your calls on the air as soon as we come back.
And we have a couple open lines, so if you want to chime in on anything, give us a call.
Any thoughts about the State of the Union, whether there should be a minimum wage increase? Want to get a little later, whether the government should be thinking about having a universal preschool.
I think it's kind of cool. I don't know.
For the kids. All right, right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you by Mike Kay and Health Insurance Giant. For top quality coverage at the rock bottom lowest prices in the industry, 800-THE-GIANT. Online at healthinsurancegiant.com. The Riff.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
World-class chef Lorena Garcia on inspiring Taco Bell's new Cantina Steak Burrito.
When Taco Bell started, I said, a great steak burrito starts with great steak. They send me the steak, I kept sending them back. No, not tender enough. No, it's gotta be thicker. More flavor.
It took 9 tries, but we finally nailed it. Taco Bell's new Cantina Steak Burrito with new thick-cut, deliciously marinated steak and Chef Lorena Garcia approved. Click or tap the banner for nearest store. Live Moss at participating locations.
How do you keep an older car running like new? Just ask a Ford customer.
Jackie, tell me why somebody should bring their car here to the Ford dealership for service instead of those other places.
They have wonderful service. I come and make sure I get my oil changed, and when they tell you your tires need to be rotated, you got to get that done as well.
The Works, $39.95 or less, minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 3/31/13.
At Advance Auto Parts, we don't do anything just partway. We go full throttle. We don't just sell batteries. Oh, no. We install them fast and free with purchase on most vehicles. And we mean fast. If strapping on an experimental jetpack would help us install your battery any faster, we'd do it. Unfortunately, jetpacks can be squirrely. Too bad, because we really wanted those things. Fast, free battery installation at Advance. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much and welcome back. We're talking some about the President's State of the Union speech and where he called for a raise in the minimum wage to $9 an hour. Anybody opposed to that? Anybody like us think it ought to be maybe even $12 an hour?
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I've run into small business owners that are operating, if they're lucky, at such a thin profit margin. But it's unfortunate. I don't know that that's the best. And they say, geez, they may not even be able to stay in business.
Right, right. Yeah, sure.
So maybe they shouldn't. I hate to say this, but maybe they shouldn't be. What if they said the only way I can stay in business is if I can pay people $5 an hour? I mean, it's possible. Labor eats up a lot of a lot of cash.
Sure does.
In any enterprise.
You need to be a multitasker anymore. Yeah. You do it all yourself.
All right, let's get some calls. Here is Mike in Clyde Township. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I see when you started the beginning of the program, you was talking about people in the middle, which I consider myself one. I agree with you guys on more stuff than not. But I'm an independent. And
so are we.
I am sorry. That's just, you know, I pissed off a lot of Republicans because of that, too, because I'm in a Republican township, and I refuse to run under the Republican banner.
There you go.
And but I do the same way. I'm not going to rerun as a Democrat because I'm not a Democrat either. And I think the media itself is kind of trying to eliminate the people in the middle, the independents, and I hate to say it, that you're kind of doing the same thing with gun control, because you're saying because people are radical right if they believe in the right to protect themselves and then don't want the added registration and the added paperwork and stuff that's already proven not to work, you're trying to tell me that I'm a radical right, but I'm not.
Well, and I never said that. Let's go back a little to how
this
is
putting words in our mouth thing always cracks me up. Yeah, we never called you. We don't know you. We don't know if you're radical anything. And by the way, independent to me doesn't say middle at all.
Yeah, we are.
It's a kind of a little more all over
but
the place.
Like, how is the media trying to eliminate the middle? I don't see any evidence
because
of that.
Because everything's either Democrat or Republican, almost 99% of the time.
Well, how would they, I'm not sure what you mean. How would they, I mean, those are the two major parties, and the so-called independents usually wind up, when that, if
1%
you're voting,
of the vote.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be a long, 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 long time before a third party actually happens. Would love to see it. Wouldn't we, Peter?
Oh, I would love to see it, too.
Just not the... I wouldn't want to.
Well, as long as there's all this money there, and I never said that anybody that doesn't want registered. I didn't say anything about it. I mean, it's always a bad week for gun enthusiasts because there's always people, shooting people to death. And
I mean, I think
shooting
pretty much
their girlfriends and
I don't know if you're talking about something you thought you heard on an old show, but all we really said tonight about gun control was in reference to President Obama's Save the Union speech, where he talked about Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. So my question to you is, what do you think that meant?
On him deserving a vote?
When he said Gabby Giffords deserves a vote, the people, the kids of Newtown deserve a vote. I want to know what you think.
I don't know what he meant.
That's why I'm asking. Yeah,
I just think it was sort of rhetorical flourish.
Yeah.
Because I'm sorry, go ahead.
He doesn't want it to be tied up like 99% of everything else that's been trying to go through the Congress has done, and he just wants to see it voted on, which I agree with. I just don't think that the added laws and everything we're talking about is going to make any kind of difference.
Well, I tend to agree with you. For one thing, I don't think any laws are going to get passed, and I think this murderous rampage that we see every single day in this country is going to continue. And it doesn't matter that 99% of gun owners have their guns under control and act responsibly and what have you. I mean, mostly I'm concerned, and I'm not putting you in the slightest, Mike, is at some the level of hysteria, the Ted Nugents of the world and those people that are arming themselves against a tyrannical government and think that they've got to travel through the suburbs armed to the teeth because, who knows when somebody's going to start spraying the restaurant they're in with you know.
Now, I wonder what you were thinking, Mike, when you said some of us don't think we should have to register. You think that people shouldn't have to register their guns?
No, I think that's a horrible idea, especially the way the internet and all the hacking and everything that's going on. All you're going to do is make a registration that can be hacked by the criminals, and they're going to know who's got guns, who doesn't, and where they can go to rob places.
Well, you know what? That is fanciful, and I really don't have any time to talk about that.
I think Mike sounded a little bit like Ted Nugent.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that, say, well, let's see, Werby's got a gun. I better not go in his house, but let me check. No one next door does. I'm going to go break into their house. I mean, people don't usually break into houses. I mean,
or have access to those types of records to begin with.
I was thinking, I've been thinking for weeks about mentioning this, but I think I'm going to lay this out right now.
Peter? Yeah.
I lived in a neighborhood once so bad that when I went to work here on WRIF, did like overnights, and I can, my wife slept with an M1 carbine under the bed.
I don't know what that is, but I know it's a gun, and I do know this story.
And
a
30-shot banana clip in it with the safety off.
Damn.
And she was worried because, for one thing, there was a serial rapist.
She is kind of badass to begin with.
There was a serial rapist in the neighborhood that had raped two women like four houses down from us.
Oh, my God.
And I would come home. Talk about, you know, what I always say, I do not.
I wouldn't have stayed there.
Hold on. We didn't. We moved. We moved. The person most at danger is not an intruder, but someone in your home. I would come home, like, after doing the all-night shift here at WRIF, and the door to the upstairs was locked, and that was the thing, that she'd have to get up and unlock it, and I would yell from the bottom of the stairs, and I'd hear her say, and I'm thinking, I'm not going up there. You know, I mean, really.
Yeah. She's sleepy, she's groggy, she's scared.
The other thing is, I worked at an office because at a time when the right wing had actually, in this city, had actually assassinated people, killed people in this country, in this city of Detroit. And I worked at an office that right by my desk, there was a sawed-off shotgun. I mean, that's how concerned all of us were for our safety.
Yeah, and you weren't paranoid.
And I wasn't paranoid.
This wasn't a conspiracy thing.
No, I mean, we were getting threats by phone all the time. We were
it a political office?
A political office. In? Some up on Woodward. Some people had a guy had gone into this hall of these where these socialists were
them
and
damn,
shot
them damn socialists.
Hey, come on, and shot and killed one of them. And
really?
Yeah, so it's not a joke.
Right, my God.
Yeah, killed one of them, wounded two of them severely.
Because, and this was in the 60s?
Yeah.
Wow.
When I was four.
Damn.
Yeah. So, so I'm not averse to gun, but to me, you don't want to be in situations like that. And there are some horrible situations where probably that kind of activity is warranted. Mostly you want to stay away from that. And the other thing, you want to do risk assessment. So walking around, you know, in the suburbs or walking around in the city. I walk around the city of Detroit all the time.
Sure.
There is absolutely no need for me to carry a weapon, which I could. And it would have no qualms about doing and
think
no qualms about
will?
Using. Who knows what the hell is going to happen in this country?
I know.
But, you know, I learned in the Boy Scouts that those, you know.
Always be prepared or something
ABC,
like that?
ABC, always, what's ABC? I don't know. Always be prepared. Be prepared. Remember I said this, the Boy Scouts oath? On my honor, what did we say? On my honor, you know that? Did I ever say that?
I was a Girl Scout.
Well, that's what we used to say.
I got kicked out for eating all the brownies. I keep trying to tell you.
Those are magic brownies? But we used to say, on my honor, I'll do my best to help the Girl Scouts get undressed.
You'll never get my joke. I'm seriously going to have to explain it to you.
The brownies?
The commercial
you ate the brownies? Whoa. All right, let's move on here. This was been.
We digress.
Yeah. But the argument could be made, well, hey, it's just a matter of your sense of threat level, right? Mine was at a certain level, which I thought was realistic. And I assume that most people that want to go around carrying a gun or have one at hand in their house feel a threat level that warrants that.
And some of that is, I mean, there's a large amount of paranoia going on.
Well, I would say that most people, I mean, when I talked to somebody that we did the other week that says, he's way, not even in the suburb, he's way out in little towns
in the country,
and he's carrying a gun in case somebody comes into the restaurant and starts shooting, that's
paranoid. Yeah. I feel actually sorry for people who walk around with that level of fear at all times. I feel sorry for those people.
All right, let's go on. I mean, nobody has called in response to this. Let's drop it.
Okay. We keep trying.
Yeah. No, I don't know why
Mike's
I brought
fault.
That up. I don't know why I was so.
Mike made up a bunch of stuff.
I don't know why. I don't know why I was so confessional. But,
we all have our moments.
Everybody is, everybody has their own level of threat. I just, think that people, that a level of fear, you gotta, I guess, decide whether it's warranted. I guess people must feel it's warranted.
Well,
but I worry about that.
Yeah, I worry about that too. I, on a personal level, refuse to go around with that, monkey on my back. I refuse to live in fear like that.
Okay. All right, let's get Maurice from Detroit. Maurice, how you doing?
Hello, Peter.
Who's armed and dangerous?
Yeah, well, if I'm Maurice, I would be in fear because he drives a taxi cab.
Yeah.
Hey, Peter, you said you was in Detroit back in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know how beautiful the city was? It was a low crime rate, right?
No. It was a high murder rate in the country.
In the 60s?
Yeah.
Maybe you meant the 50s.
So what I'm driving at is, since the city has deteriorated more, the crime rate has went up more, right?
Well, that's what happens when you destroy the manufacturing base and stuff like that. Poor people tend to commit a lot of crimes.
Peter, stick with me for a minute.
Go ahead. We're with you.
Supposing that was done deliberately to drag the city down, to put the dope in there, make the money off the dope, and turn around and take the dope money and reinvest it in the city.
Yeah, I would say. Mm. I would say that's fanciful.
That's the word of the night.
No, it doesn't make a bit of sense. I mean, what happened? Listen, the manufacturing base began leaving Detroit in the 1950s because the auto manufacturers started thinking, why should we pay a union worker $3 or $4 an hour when we can go to Alabama and Georgia and pay them $1.75? And the union, stupidly, never fought against this, never stopped. I've said before, Walter Reuther in the UAW should have called a general strike the first time General Motors or Ford tried to take a plant out of Michigan from a union shop to a non-union shop. Had that happened, we probably would still have what they used to call the Paris of Detroit. People don't know the Paris of the U.S. People used to call Detroit that like 100 years ago.
They did?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it was this beautiful city where,
it is a beautiful. I think
had all this grand architecture wide streets and all of that. But, this stuff isn't done by design. It's not like, they say this is all done by a conspiracy of men who never meet. It just starts cascading downward, and then who's left? The poorest people, the vast majority of who wanted the same things out of life that everyone else does, a peaceful,
yes,
clean, crime-free neighborhood. Yes. But in every poor neighborhood in the world, no matter what continent or race, color, religion, whatever, there's that 5% that's going to make our life miserable. You can't have a neighborhood, and that's the kind of neighborhood I lived in, where 5% of the young men are committed to crimes. All right, Maurice, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, I like that Maurice is always thinking, though.
He is.
He thinks outside of the box.
Yeah, well, maybe he ought to go back in.
Maurice, don't listen to him.
Here's Jeff in Ypsilanti. Jeff, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah. Hey, I just want to say about the thought of Obama raising minimum wage to $9.
Yeah.
I'm all for it because I know there's a lot of people, like I just left Speedway. There's a lady with four kids working for $8 an hour, and she said it took her 2 years to try to get that much.
Wow.
I think that's, I call BS on that.
Yeah, I guess.
That's criminal.
Because, I mean, she says it's full-time work, but, you know, they don't give her her full-time pay.
Well, that's very common.
Me
personally, I'm going to be doing forklift training here. So, yes, I know it's a profession where you're actually, like, it's a trained profession.
It's so it gets you like a trade, kind of, right?
Sure.
Yeah, trade. So, yes, I'll be making more. But I put it this way. If there's some guy working on a line next to me, and I'm moving parts off of his line, he's getting, you know, $4 and, you know, less than I am, I call BS on that, too, because he's working just as hard as I am.
Well, you're
a fair man.
I was going to just say that, Jeff, you have a sense of fairness, but that sense of fairness does not define the work world because, as you know, we always say that labor is this commodity that the people that buy it want at the lowest possible price. And one of the reasons they want to get rid of unions is that unions get everybody together and they say, look, we don't want the market wage because the market wage is so damn low that we'll be working for what they're working for in China or Bangladesh. So two things happen. One, there is this federal minimum wage, which artificially boosted the cost of labor. And then labor unions were able to say, look, we're not your slaves. We're not your peons. We're not your serfs. We demand a quality life as well. And of course, the owners called out the National Guard and the Pinkerton detectives and the scabs and the stoolies and the goons and did everything they could. Killed hundreds of American workers who were trying to unionize in the 1930s. And now, though, we're going back to what it was before all this because the people at the top figure, hey, you know, they're showing this weakness. They don't have the strength that they did. They don't have a movement like there was. We can start getting this all cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And what it winds up to be, they've got a lot more money. And as a population, the rest of the population, the bottom 99%, have a lot less, right?
Yeah. Well, this thing, I live right next to an old Ford plant right here in Ypsilanti.
Yeah.
I was talking to some guy at church. He said he used to work there. And Ypsilanti used to be a great place when that Ford plant was open.
Mm.
Everyone left. Ypsilanti kind of went downhill.
Now yeah, I know. That's true all
happens,
over.
Yeah.
That's what's...
So I mean, think about Flint.
The economy was better for Ypsilanti, you know, itself, when Ford had their plant here. Ford pulled out, people stopped coming around, and certain people got desperate when they got out of, you know, work. And they would do anything and everything they can to fight for their family. And, I mean, I don't put it against the guy. If you're going to steal from someone to try to feed your family, that's one thing. If you're doing it just to steal, you know, I would give you a dollar if you asked me for your family. You know?
Yeah, it's survival. I mean, this is how people are surviving.
Yeah, but if we as a nation are at the level of survival rather than living, I mean, that's what's happening. I
can't believe we're even having to say this.
Increasingly, because the rich got hit pretty bad by Bush's, the end of Reaganomics there. They got hit. They took a pretty big hit, but they got it all back. But the middle class hasn't gotten it back. The working class hasn't gotten it back. And the poor, well, they're just about where they were when they, you know, nothing really affected them one way or the other. But the fact that there is this enormous poor class in the United States, by some reckoning, half of this country is either poor or near poor. And still, the amount of wealth that exists here is just phenomenal. All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate it. Here is Mike. Mike's in Fenton. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, you're right on that, Peter. It's 46% of the American citizens have less than $500 in the bank. The banks used to make their money off of people keeping their money in the banks. Now they're just stealing it. But I called to talk about the minimum wage.
Sure.
It's basically an insult to our integrity, the minimum wage, and the minimum wage isn't the problem. The problem is these people are running things and they're keeping all the money for themselves. Another $1.40 an hour isn't going to be enough to do anything and isn't going to put any money in any bank. And these poor people are just getting worse and worse. And 18% of the black population is unemployed. you know, and it's just out of control. And so as far as the minimum wage goes, that's just a smokescreen for something to talk about. And I take it as an insult because really they need to do something about the problems that they created that they're a part of and they keep doing. And then we're just supposed to be stupid and they're just going to tell us whatever on the their rich media. The rich people run the media.
Well, I hear you. And yeah. I mean, you're right, because essentially what we ought to be talking about is a living wage. I mean, why should people have to work for less than a living wage, not a minimum wage? And here, every job that exists has some importance within the whole scheme of things or it wouldn't exist, right?
Yes.
It's got to be providing some service or selling some product, manufacturing it and selling it and what have you, retail. So
getting it there, transportation.
Yeah, everything. So everybody has a role to play, yet some people literally are making $400 an hour and some people are almost not making that a month. So there's something, well, I guess the minimum wage you'd make more than that. But still, the idea that people, as President Obama said, can work a whole week and still be in poverty and do a good job and care. And you say, well, everybody can, you know, I haven't heard anybody say that in a long time. Anybody can make it up the ladder if they really try. Well, you might say some people can and some people do. There are a few people that start off very poor and then become very wealthy.
Yeah.
And if you have expanding sectors of the economy like technology, so you got a lot of 20-somethings suddenly becoming billionaires because they invented some really cool app. But in the main, that's not the way the economy works. And those positions that are pitifully paid, those aren't going to go away, so someone's going to fill them. I mean, it's almost like, you know, we were talking just a little with Maurice about drugs. When, you know, you bust a drug dealer, the person lower down says, oh, good, you know, I can get into that spot. So, I mean, all those spots exist, but what we really got to look at, is why is there such, in such a wealthy country, people paid so miserably? How can we have, I don't know if all economists would agree with that almost 50% of people are poor or near poor, but the very fact that that is a contentious figure,
yeah.
And at the same time, what did I have? I had something. Oh, yeah, man, I forgot that article about what do they call those places the French have where they go to vacation, like a pied-à-terre or something, P-I-E-D-I-A-terre, you know, earth. But it's where they just live part of the year, like a cottage or something.
Okay.
Well, these.
It's like going up north.
Yeah.
To your
north,
cabin.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a pied-à-terre, if I'm saying that correctly.
Pied-à-terre.
But at the Plaza Hotel, you know, right at Central Park South.
Yeah, sure.
Avenue, they've turned that into condos. They're multi-million-dollar condos.
Mm-hmm.
And like 3/4 of them are always empty because people have just bought those as like investments. They don't live there. And it's true all over New York that they have these condominiums that are devoid of people because these people have spent $3 million, $5 million, $7 million, $11 million essentially for an apartment.
And they don't, crazy.
But they live in their home and they just, and that's just open in case they want to pop in
to the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, you know, could you imagine me saying that Republicans are correct about something?
I think I've heard you say it once.
All right.
In 14 years.
Yeah. All right. Well, twice when we come back. Patrick and Kevin, we got you when we come back. Open lines. And here is the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
You ain't living in Southeast Asia.
The Riff. Riff.
Julie, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
And our phone number, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Jalene ought to be running back in here pretty quickly, figuring we had a lot more commercials, which we did not. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I didn't even mention our Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. Come like us. And speaking of the 1960s, that was the MC5, the old Grandy Ballroom. Tonight at exactly 1 hour and 50 seconds, I'm going to be interviewing Frank Joyce, who organized a delegation to Vietnam for the 40th anniversary celebration of the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, which ostensibly ended the war there. And he was there in 1970, so he was there 43 years ago. Also, Marjorie Hines, who is the founder of the Free Expression Project and author of Priest of Our Democracy, discussing the history of the McCarthy era and how teachers were driven out of their jobs because of their political beliefs. Mm. Not good. All right, how do I agree with Republicans?
Yeah, please.
How about this?
Please share.
Here
this,
we go.
This thrills me.
Hemp growing. Hemp, you know, hemp finds allies of a new stripe in Kentucky. And there are the Republicans. Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, he announced his support for growing hemp in Kentucky, his home state. And a panel of Republican-controlled Kentucky State Senate, they unanimously approved a bill to license hemp growers. And it was promoted by the state agricultural commissioner and three members of the state's congressional delegation, including Rand Paul, who removed his jacket to testify in a white shirt that he announced was made of hemp fibers.
It surprises me.
And as you know, you want to take a little lunch break here? Huh? Did your mom ever tell you not to talk with your mouth full?
Carry on.
Okay. So, Kentucky, there's actually eight other states that have adopted laws to allow commercial hemp growing. Although the practice is effectively blocked by federal law that makes no distinction between hemp and marijuana.
Well, yeah, it's you can't get high off of this stuff. It's just a very strong, you know, for rope, it's very strong.
Yeah, the sails of the USS Constitution were made of hemp. Yeah, hemp was a big thing for cloth. And remember, you know, I have that hemp shirt.
Yeah, I have some hemp kind of hippie pants that lounge around.
It says both marijuana and hemp are the same species, cannabis sativa, although there's also cannabis indica, I'm told. But hemp has only a trace of the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana.
Psychoactive.
I like
they make it.
It
sound so crazy.
You're right. At a hearing on Monday in Frankfort, the Kentucky capital, the state commissioner's opposition to hemp growing was challenged by the former CIA director, R. James Woosley. He said, the specter of people getting high on industrial hemp is pretty much exactly like saying you can get drunk on old duels. You know,
for real.
Where is it, though? Oh, yeah. Rodney Brewer, the commissioner of the Kentucky State Police, said if hemp farming were legal, marijuana growers would hide their plants in hemp fields and the police could not tell them apart. Oh, my God. But Mr. Brewer said they are identical in appearance when it comes to the naked eye, and said that legalizing hemp would be a boom for pot growers. But Mr. Woosley from the CIA said he favored hemp because of my interest in prosperity for rural America, and argued that no pot farmer would hide plants in a hemp field for fear that low potency hemp would cross-pollinate with the marijuana and lower the concentration of THC, its psychoactive ingredient.
I was surprised that all hemp used today here in the U.S. is imported mostly from China. Well, that doesn't surprise me, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That not, I don't know. That was surprising. And I didn't realize the Dr. Bronner's magic soap.
Oh, yeah.
You know that?
Yeah.
They have a hemp variety as well. And they get theirs from China, and that's a company that is based here in the United States. But didn't they sell out to someone? Someone can tell me that. I was kind of.
I mean, that Bronner's soap with all those biblical stuff all over and a little teeny writing.
Do they have biblical stuff on it?
Oh yeah, it's about the
But the hippies have taken it over.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It's
well, good. Good. I thought maybe like Procter & Gamble or something.
Well, now I don't know. I had heard something like that. Which
all right, let's get some more calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Patrick in Macomb. Patrick, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Going good.
Hi, Patrick.
Well, I wanted to talk to you guys. I know it's probably been a little bit since you talked about it, but about carrying a gun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been carrying, well, at least open carrying since, 2008 now.
What do you mean opening? Strapped around your waist?
Yep. There's a difference between a concealed carry when it's not visible or open
carry. Yeah, we get it.
Yeah.
Why do you feel the need for everyone to have to look at your gun?
Well, you know, it's not really that. It was just I didn't have the license to concealed carry it, and I wasn't going to break the law.
Okay, so why don't you conceal it now?
Wait. So you don't, I can just go out with a cowboy with a holster and a gun in it with no license?
It must be a registered and licensed gun, though, but you don't need to have a concealed carry license to carry a gun.
Okay, well, because it's not concealed, yeah.
Yeah.
Why in the world would, I asked somebody this about, if I saw you walking down the street and, I'm going to say something and I'll apologize in advance because you're going to probably take offense of this. If I saw you walking down the street or I saw you, I remember the person was talking at the Arts.
You say what you would think and I'll tell you what I would think.
Arts Beats and Eats, I'd say, this guy's a nut. I gotta get out of the way.
I would say, what a D-bag, for real.
that's not legal to carry there because there are alcoholic beverages sold.
No, it is legal to carry there. They made an exception for it. I saw a D-bag on the corner with his gun, acting all cool, like, mess with me. It's like, I'm thinking, come on, we're at an art festival eating corn dogs.
Yeah, but here's what I'm thinking, Patrick. You know, I mean, do you really think that you're as enough at threat or at risk that you have to go out in public like this? I mean, you must realize you would make a lot of people uncomfortable. You'd make me very uncomfortable.
Well, you know, it comes down to that. I didn't do that for very long. I got my license very soon afterward. But when I worked as an EMT and a paramedic, I used to work downtown, which is actually a job where you'd really want to carry a gun if you could, but we're not allowed to. But, you know, I don't carry my gun because I think something bad is going to happen every day. Like you guys said that I'm paranoid. I'm really not. I really trust people. But when it really comes down to it, I carry it for that one day when I meet that one person that isn't trustworthy.
Well, wait a minute. What do you think the odds are for that? I mean, listen, we know that this is a crazy society, and people with guns act out all the time in criminal acts, in interpersonal stuff, in, you know, we read about this all the time. And I've almost thrown up my hands about any way to actually resolve it. We're too armed. There's no political will to actually change.
More guns, more gun violence, more killings.
So, and talking to you, I probably think, well, geez, this guy's not going to do anything. But I would say that the risk factor compared to the mentality, when I was sitting in an office with a gun within reach, I mean, I didn't think about it every second, but it kind of framed my sense of where I was in the world. And I think that's bad for your head.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, since I've been carrying from 2008, I've had to pull my gun twice. Both of them I've been held up either at gunpoint or knife point, and just literally pulling the gun made the assailant run for it. And I would like to think that it saved my life, and it also saved my wife when she was with me.
Well, you must be a magnet for this stuff because, I'll tell you what, I was I'm trying to think. Once in my life, somebody pulled a knife on me and said, give me all your money. And I had a free press in my hand. So, you know, it was before.
Which is a newspaper.
Yeah, newspaper, yeah.
There's people
listening around the world. Yeah. And, I looked at the guy and he looked at me and he said, don't run. And I threw the paper in his face and tore off running, leaped some bushes, and just kept running two blocks. And someone asked me one time, was he chasing you? I said, I have no idea. Because as the great pitcher Satchel Paige said, don't look back. Somebody might be gaining on you.
All you need is a newspaper.
So you're right. I could have, if I would have had a gun, I probably could have said, you got a knife? I got a gun. You're in trouble, buddy.
But I've got the free press.
I have the free press on my side. Yeah, but the point being is that a lot of stuff, you got to kind of work the actuary tables. And I guess you've had a string of bad ones, but maybe you've had it all, you know. All right, Patrick, thank you very much.
I'm glad you're concealing that now, because I'm going to take back what I called you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. All right, here's Kevin and Wayne. Kevin, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for your patience. You're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, okay. I was just calling to say that I disagree with Obama raising the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
How come?
Yeah, why?
I currently make a little over $9 an hour, and I feel like he's saying that he doesn't want a full-time working Americans to be working under the poverty level, but I feel like he's just raising the poverty level. So basically, he's just sucking people like myself who work hard 40 hours a week down into poverty. More into poverty.
I got it. Here's the way it is.
Okay.
If right now 7.25 is a poverty level, he's saying that if it raises to 9, then that'll be the poverty level. But here's the thing. One of the things that it does, Kevin, there is a slight inflationary facet to raising the minimum wage, which means then people that are, you know, the minimum wage is 7.25, you're making 9, and suddenly, you're working at the minimum wage, and that's pressure on employers to actually raise your wage as well. So there's everybody can conceivably.
Right, but like with that, when minimum wage was $5.15 an hour in Michigan, I was working for my first job. I was making $6 an hour, which is 85 cents over minimum wage. And I didn't stick around for long. I went to another job where I was making $7 an hour. But anyways, I came back to that first job several years later when the minimum wage had been raised to $7.40 an hour, and I was making $7.40 an hour. So I don't think that the other wages above minimum wage raise proportionally, although many of them do go up. I don't think they go up proportionally. Like,
well, how can people get more money? I mean, there's only three ways. The least possible is the generosity of the employer, which sometimes occurs, rewarding people that they think are deserving of it. What happens, it happens less. It happens much less. The other way would be what you said you oppose. And a third way would be unionization.
Our dollar's value is dictated by supply and demand. Yeah. And so when you put more dollars out there, that doesn't increase supply. I mean, production stays the same, so.
Yeah, but there's been this great rise in productivity over the last 30 years, and none of it has gone to the people that have produced it. All of it has been taken by the upper classes. I mean, it's what I said. It's a system of looting. And what statutory wage ceilings, or minimums rather, do, and what unionization do, is artificially raise that, because apparently you can't depend on the goodwill of the employers overall. There are a lot of generous people. I've worked in small places and big places where, some were better than others. Some did whatever they could to not pay you anymore. Mm-hmm. Others tried to reward you. All right. Well, thank you for your opinion. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Gary in Detroit. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. How you doing?
We're good.
Hey. I was just wondering, since you're talking about, gun laws, pot laws, and all this other stuff, here's a little clip for you. Talking about these statutes that you're going into these foreign jurisdictions. The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form of law and the name of law, in its reality, no law at all, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose, since unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment and not merely from the date of its decision. So bearing it.
Well, who determined? Only the courts determine its constitutionality.
Okay, what courts? Your statutory courts? If you take an oath of office, you have an oath to uphold common law, civil law, or admiralty law. Now, this.
Well, wait a minute. We have a constitution that specifies the role of different branches of government, and for instance, the Supreme Court decides in 1896 it says laws for segregation of the races is permissible. And then 1954 it says, boy, we made a horrible mistake, and it doesn't meet muster under due process of the law or equal protection under the law. So, I mean, it's fluid. I mean, that's, this is, what do they say? You know, it's not supposed to be a law. It's supposed to be, not be a law of men, but it is, of course, because it has to do a lot with the political currents of a particular time, right?
Well, the thing is you're dealing with private corporations. The state of Michigan is a private corporation incorporated in Michigan, the Republic, 174 years ago.
You know what? This is too technical for me, and I suspect from the audience, Jerry. Right, I don't know what you're talking about.
My eyes glossed over.
So we're going to have to talk about
that. Moving right along.
All right. But, you know, by the way.
But thanks for calling the show.
By the way, I said that that the band Rush were these.
They're into Ayn Rand.
Into Ayn Rand, yeah. Let's see, Alex Lifeson, the guitar player for Rush, gave an interview in the June 2012 issue of High Times. No less.
Uh-huh.
And they asked him, do you consider yourself a libertarian? He said, I think I'm a liberal. I am certainly socially liberal. And I think government can play an important role in our lives, which libertarians don't believe. I mean, remember, this is a Canadian
band. Yeah.
As far as our album, 2112 and the tribute to Ayn Rand, I read one of her books. She was a little too far out for me, for Neil. It was a period in his life and now he's kind of moved on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good.
We're glad. Come on back to us.
Yeah. Right. That's good.
That's crazy stuff.
Where are we at here? Here, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Buddy in Ann Arbor. Buddy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm doing good. How are you?
Good.
Well, I wanted to talk about this gun stuff, but I heard Kevin talking while I was on hold. And I work in a grocery store making $7.75 an hour. I feel like you're really underpaid, and hearing that minimum wage might go up is a huge boon for me.
See, there you go.
Yeah.
You are way underpaid.
Yeah.
And you probably work really hard.
I do, and I paid about $200 in union dues this year and can't get that back.
Wait.
You're unionized?
This is a unionized union shop?
And yeah.
And you're making $7.75?
I'm in USCW.
Wow, yeah.
Wow.
And all the only thing
And I can't even afford the health benefits because it's like $35 per week just for myself.
That's criminal. Hey, you know what? There's a similar situation. My union, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFTRA, and there's been cases where we've organized the shop, but we're unable to get a contract that was sufficient enough, and I don't want to name where it was. It wasn't a radio station. It was something else to do with radio. It doesn't matter. It wouldn't be fair of me to say. And the people, even with the fact they were making like something like that, like $8 an hour, and the union mm-hmm. got them a raise to $11.75 an hour. And that's almost like a third. That's almost like a 30% raise.
Yeah.
And yet it still did not, they did not make, you know, unions have to have these rules to make their, like their health plans and their pension funds and all that, economically sound. So these people, even with this raise, were not getting enough money, were not earning enough money, what they call enough money in the jurisdiction in order to qualify for the health plan or for the pension benefits. Mm. So essentially, people that were unionized with the idea of improving their status they weren't doing anything except paying dues to my union. I mean, our union is not corrupt. It's, people don't get big salaries. They're not driving Lincolns like the Teamsters or anything like that, you know. But the point being is that they weren't able to get a contract that afforded the workers enough, to cover, to make it worth their while. I mean, they had a grievance procedure and what have you, which is a good thing. And eventually the unit, decertified. In other words, blew off, the union. And, so then, what happened? The company just fired all those people that supported the union and put in a bunch of people that were saying, yes, sir. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even in my job, I've worked myself to the point where I've had some medical problems. Like, I was doing a full 40 hours a week, but that was too much strain just on my body physically, and I had to cut it down. And my employer had a problem with that.
Well, aren't they sweet?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we are getting back. I said earlier, we're going back to the 1920s, and then I said maybe it's the 1880s. And I think that could be, if you've got some spare time, just go, just Google. Yeah, I was going to say read a book about this. Just Google labor conditions, 1880s, or union struggles, 1880s.
Right before you quit your job, say, you know, this isn't the 1880s, you know.
Yeah, they'll say, yes, it is.
They'll say, huh?
Goodbye.
Then right. You can tell them to Google it.
All right. Now, we were talking about Bronner's.
Dr. Bronner's.
Dr. Bronner, B-R-O-N-N-E-R-S.
The liquid soap.
Yeah, and it's kind of a peppermint soap, and they say.
Well, there's peppermint, there's almond, there's a bunch of different flavors.
You're supposed to be able to, like, brush your teeth with it.
And yeah, but you don't want to go you know where with that peppermint. Let me tell you.
Where the sun don't shine.
Yeah, not that I would know, but
yeah,
I've been told.
But John, who you can call at 313-298-WRIF, said the reason for Bronner's religious jargon on his bottle. His parents were killed in the Holocaust, and the quotations express his morals and his religious beliefs.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Didn't know.
All right, let's. We got Dan and Bob. That means we got room for you. 313-298-WRIF. And here is Dan in Mount Clemens. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
We're good.
Good. How you
doing? Good. I'd like to raise the. I wish they would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And but the thing that I don't think that is right is when they raise the minimum wage. You know, then everything goes up. So what they need to do is put a price freeze on things so that people can keep the money.
Yeah, keep the value of their raise. Well, it doesn't go up like that because remember there's the pressures of the market. So if there's $2 an hour more, say, or I'm trying to, all right, Jalene always says don't do math on the air. Which, so that would be
listens to me.
Another $80 a week, and you start tabulating all that, it can add up for some small firms.
But it adds up for the people.
Without a doubt. So, but if they start, they're selling a widget for, previously for $3, and they go, oh, I've got to pay $2 an hour, so I'm going to raise my prices a dollar. Someone else in the market's going to say, well, I'm going to keep my prices the same. So the competition keeps that down. I mean, there is this expansion of, not the expansion of wealth, but there's also expansion of the money supply and all that. So when the first minimum wage bill came out in 1938, the minimum wage was 25 cents. And people were going, wow, that's great. I can't believe it. I was making a dime an hour.
Oh, man.
But now, of course, but is that if the minimum wage in the 1960s, we were saying earlier, would have translated to almost $10 an hour in today's wages. But here, I mean, you could do something. I don't know what kind of formula you could devise, and it would have to be done, obviously, bureaucratically. But it could be based on the value of a company and how many employees and what have you. Because, there's big corporations that are paying people crap wages. So you could, if some company is just, raking in hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, $15 an hour minimum wage. Why shouldn't the people that are working in the trenches, doing the really hard work and creating the wealth, why shouldn't they share in a portion of it as opposed to the people who so-called own, who've done nothing, who may have inherited wealth, inherited the stock, or just played the stock market and got, who produced nothing, actually.
And what's amazing is when you treat your employees better, you pay them better, they actually want to work harder for you. They feel rewarded, properly rewarded, you know?
Yeah.
They feel respected.
All right. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Here is Bob in Auburn Hills. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. Hello. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're good. Hi.
Yeah, I called because I'm 41 years old. I live by myself. I pay a mortgage. And guess what? I'm making $9 an hour.
Wow.
I'm scrimping. I'm surviving. But I'm getting tired of these 20-something-year-olds, 30-something-year-olds, a.k.a. young adults, not knowing what it means to be an adult yet. Your time to have fun is in your teens and your early 20s.
Yeah.
Once you graduate high school or even college, buckle down.
Oh, I don't believe in that at all.
We've never done that. We've
Peter
gone into radio.
We don't agree.
Yeah, well, I'm talking the average Joe.
There you go.
Well, right. We're pretty average, I'd say.
Well, he also got a nice job. It's better than being, say, slinging burgers in a restaurant or working in a restaurant. You got a nice chair you can sit at, nice comfy headphones, this, that. But
these are pretty comfy headphones, yeah. I got to say.
The point I'm saying is that if you go the extra mile, the boss is going to notice that. And if you ask him every couple of months, hey, can I get a performance review, eventually they're going to get sick and tired of hearing for a performance review, give you one. And if you did the job that warrants a raise, you're going to get one.
Well, let me ask you this,
Bob. Maybe.
Yeah. All right, and even during the last increase in the minimum wage, people were compensated due to percentage it was raised.
Well, let me ask you this. If they raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour, which I bet they won't, how would that position you? In other words, suddenly you would be going from making a dollar something over the minimum wage to the minimum wage. Would that give you better leverage at work, do you think?
Actually, it would, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what most
people... Because if you have experience on your side as opposed to somebody just starting out, yeah, you're going to have a little bit of advantage.
Yeah.
And if you show any worth to the company, you're going to be valued what you're worth.
All right. Thank you, Bob. I want to get one more call.
If you have a cool boss,
yeah,
there's a lot of bosses who don't even care.
Yeah, they expect you to just do whatever they tell them. Yeah. All right, thank you. Which I think most bosses are saying, yeah. Here's David in Port Huron. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you guys doing? I've been listening to your radio show I'm like 47. I've been listening to it for 20, 30 years.
Wow.
At least. Yeah.
Wow.
But,
thank you.
Yeah. I like what you guys are talking about. I was just concerned about why are we spending billions of money on a Mars rock? And when there's not, like, who cares if there's water on Mars?
You know,
I don't know why that just sounded so funny, because I really could give a rat's ass
me
if there's
neither.
Water on Mars.
I know. And then we're spending all this money on a stupid moon rock. You know what I mean?
What's the moon rock?
Well,
is that this asteroid thing?
No, it's a dance. No.
Well, that's the moon rock.
I'll tell you, David. In a period where we're talking about having a deficit, we're talking about having to cut programs and all of this. Once in a while, I've said, just to be provocative, we shouldn't even have a space program, because what is it going to do?
You were being provocative. You mean it. I think the same thing.
And
I have a friend who works for NASA.
And people go absolutely nuts, because people love the space program. It is so exciting.
Why are we exploring? Why are we doing it?
Yeah, why?
I know.
Yeah. So,
I have no idea why we're doing that. We're spending billions of money on it.
Well, David, listen up. I want to talk a little more about where
God.
Our money's going. All right, thank you for
Thanks,
bringing that
David.
Up. All right, because where our money is going is mainly, and that's a pretty big expenditure, but where these wars that have cost now $1 trillion or something like that, and here is an article in is today no this was the 14th. Main hurdle in the withdrawal from Afghanistan is getting the gear out.
Yeah.
As the military begins carrying out President Obama's order to cut force levels in Afghanistan by half over the next year. So anybody that worries, we're still going to have a lot of our soldiers over there running around. Getting 34,000 troops out is the easy part. You just get them out of a transport plane and fly them home. But after 11-plus years of war, now here I want to connect up these things. Remember that phrase, 11-plus years of war.
Okay.
The accumulated American hardware in Afghanistan amounts to more than 600,000 pieces of equipment valued at $28 billion.
Whoa.
You know who paid for that?
You and I.
Yeah. But I want to...
Not happy about it.
But that sounds like you're talking to me. I want to say it right to the audience. And say,
okay.
You.
You.
Yeah. And there were certain options of where to put this, where the government could take the collected tax revenue and spend it. $28 billion on this war. Well, let me get to the end of this. In that arsenal are systems that always present challenges to international shipping, including mine-resistant troop transports and Stryker infantry fighting vehicles, each built with tons of armor and heavy tractor trailers and tankers. They're flying those out.
My God.
Because the land routes are all screwed up. Anyway, so far the heavy vehicles have all been shipped out by air because Afghanistan is landlocked. It has a primitive road system, and the Taliban remains strong in many parts of the country.
So we went there and did what? And we,
So here was the United States, the strongest army the world has ever seen, the most technologically advanced.
We spend the most.
This massive military advantage and can't win over guys that, remember I quoted, if anybody's longtime listener, like David who was just on.
With their Kalashnikovs.
And fighting barefoot. Remember the guy who was in Iraq? Yeah. He said, I like to fight barefoot.
Yep.
I mean, this is just Vietnam, where, in fact, if you listen at 1 o'clock, one of the things that Frank Joyce, my guest, who just returned from Vietnam after a 43-year absence, talks about the inability of the United States that killed millions of people. Millions of Indochinese, third generation of Indochinese children are still suffering birth defects from essentially what was chemical warfare, Agent Orange, and of course Americans suffered from that, as well. And yet the people that perpetrated this wind up to be the respected politicians, the Kissingers, and Nixon only went down because of things like Watergate. Who suffers? The ordinary person from this country could get sent over there to do the dirty work of an empire that bases its wars on lies, like the war in Vietnam was based on a lie.
Sure was.
War in Iraq. This is, by the way, just the 15th on Friday was the 10th anniversary of the largest anti-war, largest demonstrations of any kind, the largest anti-war demonstration in world history, when millions of people around the world said to George W. Bush, you are lying.
Were we there?
I was.
Yeah, I
you
can't
weren't.
Remember.
You weren't.
I've been to a couple of those,
yeah, but this
not
was
that
in New
one.
York City.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
was a million people in New York City closed down the entire east side
right.
of New York in
Ooh,
about 8-degree weather.
Yeah.
And of course, as usual, the conservatives and the mainstream, a lot of wars were liberals as well, ostensibly, or Democrats at least, World War I, another one based on lies, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so what's left? This mountain of corpses in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, the most powerful military in the world cannot accomplish its goals. Billions spent, $28 billion just in hardware, forgetting about everything else. Hundreds of thousands of Afghan citizens killed and their lives disrupted. For what? It's not even clear. You know, it's not even, just war for oil. It's just war for war. It's just keep the war
the
machine
military
going.
Industrial complex.
Yeah.
Floating, and then some.
Let's see. As Mr. Obama delivered his State of the Union address on Tuesday night, almost 40,000 armored or other large vehicles remained in Afghanistan. The military has a goal of bringing out 1,500 of them every 30 days.
By air. Amazing.
A target it can reach by air, but there are just 22 months until the American-led combat mission ends in 2014.
Yeah, so 40,000 of these, 1,500 a month in 22 months. Don't
right.
do the math.
Yeah, I won't. Hey, your final thoughts, because it's our final segment coming up. There's a decreasing number of people who think that the banks were responsible for the Great Recession that we're still suffering. You're not, if you're on Wall Street, you're not suffering it, but a lot of ordinary people are. And it right in 2008, 9, 10, what have you, people thought overwhelmingly it was the banks. For some reason, their minds are changing.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to GEICO, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click Bam Boom. Visit GEICO.com today. Click Bam Boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. It's our final segment, so please do join us on open lines. And get this. Hello, Peter. Long time no speak. This is Lonnie in Tokyo. So I don't know whether he's listening live. I can't even imagine. This is probably afternoon drive in Tokyo.
Could be listening right. Live, yeah.
Trust all is going away. As a VVAW member, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, I was just contacted by somebody regarding the following and wanted to pass it along, especially point B regarding a speaker. And said, I just wanted to tell you about a benefit fundraiser for Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning is the American GI who stole all those communiques that wound up at WikiLeaks. It's going to be Saturday at the Old Miami in
allegedly.
Detroit. Yeah, on February 23rd. I'll put it up on my website calendar. Yeah, it's next Saturday. And it is, I don't have much information here. It says,
just look to peterwerby.com. Yeah, you'll have it up in a couple of days or tomorrow, maybe.
Yeah, I will. Most of this is invite as many veterans as possible at the Old Miami. What? It's a weird combination of a vets bar and a alt rock bar.
I know. Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it? Patrick in Mount Clemens wrote in on the gun debate. His brother-in-law was at a children's playhouse today with his 5-year-old daughter. There was. This is what Pat said. Actually, some idiot there with a handgun on his belt, exposed for everyone to see. He said, this clown was also there with small children. This is a business, a children's like jungle gym place.
Yeah.
The police were called and responded. They spoke with this idiot and apparently told him he had to cover the gun up. I'm guessing he had a CCW permit. Why would someone
no,
feel...
No. You don't need... If you have it, you don't need
no,
it.
No, they told him he had to cover it up. So they,
well, then it'd be concealed. If he
they covered told him
it up.
He had to cover it up.
But then it was concealed.
Right.
But he'd have to
but
have
he
a,
had it open.
But he'd have to have a concealed weapons permit. You can
that's
have.
That's what he's saying here. That's what he's saying. Peter just.
Okay, follow the bouncing ball. No. Yeah. I'm getting it.
He said, why would someone feel it necessary to carry a gun into a business with parents and children? And what kind of law allows anyone to carry a gun inside such a business? And then in capital letters, and I feel your anger, Patrick, what is wrong with these people?
If I had a kid and I, all of a sudden somebody walked in
with
a gun strapped to their waist, I don't know what I would do.
I would be like, you know what? We're going. Yeah. We're leaving.
Right. Yeah.
And I'd give them the stink eye.
I said I was going to talk just a little about this idea of people in. Decreasingly hold the banks responsible for what happened.
Decreasingly, okay.
But I want to get to something else. I was just out in California. That's why
did you change your mind? Are you ADDing on me?
I wanted to get this in here, though. This is so extraordinary. I was out in California. A friend of mine was out there. He said, come on out and stay for a few days.
Yeah.
And I said, what the hey? You know, so I went out there.
Jet setter.
Had a grand time.
You left know, me.
Cheap flight. $300 round trip.
How does that happen? That doesn't happen to L.A.
Non-stop.
No.
I just went onto the Delta. Anyway, come on.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Anyway, I read this article that said, new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that nearly 46 million adults with mental illness have a smoking rate 70% higher than those without mental illness and consume about a third of the cigarettes in the country, though they make up one-fifth of the adult population. Now, my friend and I were getting on a bus, because, you know, there, buses are just every minute come along. Mm-hmm. And this guy said, hey, can I buy a cigarette from you? And
yeah.
I said, and we said, we don't smoke. And he said, does it bother you? I have brown eyes. And I said, no. And he smiled. So I realized he was totally crazy.
Yeah.
But apparently that these huge numbers of people with mental illness are addicted to cigarettes and that nicotine actually has an effect of lessening a lot of the effects of schizophrenia, for instance.
Like it calms them down.
Yeah. It said the people with the most serious mental illnesses die on an average 25 years earlier than the general population, with many from smoking exacerbated conditions like heart or lung disease. Mm-hmm. Nicotine has an antidepressant effect, and for people with schizophrenia, helps dampen extraneous thoughts and voices.
Crazy. I have no pun.
But, you know, there's lots of other chemicals in cigarettes because there's a lot of there's people that say, that contend that it's not just the tobacco, although...
Well, they have some chemicals that make it burn faster.
Yeah.
You blow through more cigarettes.
Well, or that it keeps it burning, too. I mean,
yeah, because I know the American spirits, they burn, like, a lot slower.
They'll go out.
They will go out. Exactly.
But what struck me was that 46 million people reported in this country with mental illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have, I think, I'd have to go look at, what's their book called, of mental illnesses, but they have less severe paranoid reactions. In other words, you can have...
If they smoke.
No.
Then
this
what?
Is a condition. Just a condition. Hear me out.
I'm trying.
Okay. What it means is if you think that people from Mars are invading.
Yeah.
Or you think that you're getting messages on
people are talking via voices.
Yeah, you're getting messages on your teeth from the Venusian space fleet or something like that. You're out, you know, this is, people say, well, the guy's crazy. He must have schizophrenia. If you think there is, well, it used to be, they this phrase came about like in the 1950s. So they said that the communists were going to take over our country.
Yeah.
That there were communists everywhere, that there were all these secret
right,
communists.
Right, the whole McCarthy.
That was a less severe paranoid reaction. It was like a socially generated but socially approved paranoia.
I mean, okay.
Because... Communists weren't going to take over the country, and they weren't behind every bush. And
but a lot of people's lives were hurt by that.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's one of the guests I'm going to have tonight is talking about. But the point being that that a lot of undiagnosed people running around. So why do we have? That's what we talk about: armed madhouse, and the people that act out with their guns, right? Are fairly crazed because
look at the mass shootings and you look at who does them.
Yeah, if you're in a dispute with your wife, you don't go in and shoot at her, her lawyer, her sister.
Well, some people do.
Yeah.
There is, Peter, I wanted to direct you to the other screen.
Okay. Yeah,
there
I was
you go.
About to do that.
Okay.
All right. Here is Brian in Minneapolis. Brian, thanks for listening. How'd you hear about our show way over in Minneapolis?
We've heard from Brian before.
Correct.
Hi, Brian.
Hey,
I know who you are.
That does not negate my question.
True. Yeah, I'm actually from Michigan, the Detroit area.
Oh, so there you go. Okay.
Been listening for years. But, yeah, a couple of comments, and nothing you don't know or haven't mentioned before, but in regards to the wars overseas and the fact that we're still there, isn't it really just a money-making thing? And, you know, we didn't run out as long as possible.
Correct. And George Bush wanted to make sure his buddies were set for life.
Yeah, because, and you know, but it's like I was saying in a couple of other issues. It's not like anybody sits down and says, let's drag this out so we'll make a lot more money. They just
right.
do it.
They think it, though.
They just do it. They know that they have a vested interest in this continuing.
And they know they can.
Yeah. And if
right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Why wrap it up in 1 or 2 years when you could... I mean, just make an obscene amount of money over an entire decade.
Yeah. And they did.
Well, here, another thing. Where was I listening to this? There are an interview with somebody I heard today. But anyway, right now we're budgeted for $80 billion a year for nuclear weapons program. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons that we keep and maintain, and President Obama wants to expand portions of it. So when we start wondering,
what we call the bad parts of Obama.
Yeah. Why do we have the deficits that we have? And it's pretty clear. I mean, for one thing, most of the big nuclear power, the other one, Russia, would love to get this off the table. And just, we could make a deal probably in a minute. And we could enforce, actually, probably a complete nuclear weapons ban across the world.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, even Israel, who is probably, along with Pakistan and India, the more dangerous holders mm-hmm. of these, because, you know, with Israel, we're paying the cost to be the boss. You know, we're shipping them a few billion a year.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's sickening. Yeah, and the other comment I wanted to make really quick was about wages and listen to some of these callers about making $9, $7, $8 an hour.
I know.
I'm thinking to myself, when I was an undergrad at Eastern back in 91, 92, I was working at the Marriott in the banquet department, and we were making probably between $10 and $18 an hour. And,
wow.
And that afforded me a room in a house on Washtenaw Avenue.
Huh.
And, you know, I have 2 degrees now, and I'm making a lot more than that, obviously. But how these people are surviving off that in 2013 is just perplexing to me.
Well, I don't think
they're not thriving.
They're not thriving, and that's what I've said about when we're going to wind up with an economy. The people in the economy, like in Mexico, so a third of the population only is well-waged, and that's where the majority of capital circulates in terms of wages, commodity production, consumption, you know, well-paid services, investment sector, and all of that. And the bottom two-thirds will be huge enough to still provide labor at a very, very cheap rate, maybe to the point of even bringing back overseas manufacturers. But the people that are going out and spending $100, $150 for, you know, dinner for two and shows, you know, Broadway shows where tickets are $140 a piece.
Yes.
Fly off to California when they want. And, oh, that'd be me.
Here.
Yeah. But it was a fairly cheap flight. For me, you and I are going, wow, is that cheap?
No, that's really cheap. That's unheard of.
I know. But you know how many people in our audience, the people that are making $9 an hour, they can't. Take $300 and fly off to
that's right anywhere
to California right yeah
hey oh
but
let's...
but Brian thank you very
thank
much
thank you Brian
hey you too have a good night
yeah you too
I have a lot of relatives there in the Minneapolis great town Alan Rochester wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We talked about how we NASA the space program we think of is a little excessive to say the least.
Oh, Al in Rochester.
Al
New York.
In Rochester,
oh,
New York.
I thought she said that was. I thought she said Al Rochester called in. I'm sorry.
Alan Rochester. Alan. Oh, I get it.
Alan,
okay.
I thought she said Alan
in Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
Wrote in. He said, "Why do we need the space program? We just had a near miss by an asteroid several miles wide. 500 people were injured in Russia by." 1,000. Well,
yeah.
He said 500, so, yeah. Okay, double that. We're injured in Russia by a meteor strike in a relatively unpopulated area. Maybe next time it won't be a near miss. We have the technology to destroy this planet hundreds of times over. We certainly have the capability to blow one of these things out of the sky. We need the vision and the will to do it. It's time to stop defunding NASA.
They're getting less of a budget. Well, I don't know. I mean, they it's not,
he makes a little point.
Well,
there.
It's not so clear that
we could really stop an asteroid.
Yeah. Well, some of these too, the size of them. It's one thing. This thing was not that big. What was it? I forgot what it was. 100 feet long, 150 feet long.
Yeah.
I mean, what something comes along and it's like 200 miles long? We're going to start A-bombing it.
Something. It's like one of those Hollywood movies.
Yeah,
there.
I know.
That's when you're getting into that
could
category.
Happen. All right, real quickly. Incomes flat in recovery, but not for the 1%, says the New York Times. Incomes rose more than 11% for the top 1% of earners during the economic recovery, but not at all for everyone else, according to new data. Now, figure this. 11%, and that would be, I don't know, a little less than what President Obama is proposing for the bottom of the wage scale. Right?
You mean the minimum wage?
Yeah. You want me to do the math?
No.
Okay. All right. The numbers produced by Emmanuel says, who's an economist, shows the overall income growing by just 1.7% over the period, but there was a wide gap between the top 1% whose earnings rose by 11.2% and the other 99%. And that includes when, you know, the top, like the 99th percentile, they're making a lot of money. They're making hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? Whose earnings declined by 0.4%. Now, there is a relationship. I mean, I hope everyone realizes that. If there is income and wealth growth, and one group, this teeny weeny, weeny little sliver percentage of the population gets an 11.2% increase. If there's a raise in productivity and the rest of us, our earnings decline by 0.1%, I'm sorry, declined by like 0.5%. This is looting, isn't it? We're being looted by these wealthy people. And yet, there are ordinary working class people making $9 an hour and $15 an hour and $20 an hour, which, again, $20 an hour, that sounds like a fortune. That comes to be turns out to be $40,000 a year.
I didn't need the New York Times to tell me any of the above.
The disparity between top earners and everyone else can be attributed in part to differences in how the two groups make their money. The wealthy have benefited from a four-year boom in the stock market, while high rates of unemployment have continued to hold down income of wage earners. The other thing is people at the bottom of the wage structure don't pay much income tax. But at the top, the people that do absolutely nothing, that are just these investors, they pay 15% on their dividends.
Yeah, it's a large imbalance.
And get this, the top 10% of earners took almost 50% of all income in 2011.
My gosh.
And then the rest of us split 90%. This is the highest proportion.
Please, sir, may I have another? Please, sir.
Yeah. This is the highest proportion since 1917.
Bend over, Peter.
Yeah, well. Wow. Let's see.
It is something else.
Concern for the declining wages of working Americans and persistent high levels of inequality featured heavily in President Obama's State of the Union address this week. I thought it said he wanted to raise it to $9 from 7.25. I thought it was only 7.25. Right? You know that, I'm always talking about the New York Times.
Yeah.
The paper on Sunday costs at least $5.
It really is a pricey paper.
Yeah. I mean, somebody's got to work 3/4 of an hour just so they can buy a newspaper?
Yeah, no doubt.
What is that all about?
Well, you can get it free online, folks, nytimes.com. If you can afford to be online, have a computer.
15 million people making 7.25 an hour. And one of the things conservatives say, it's a bunch of teenagers, which isn't true at all.
That's not true at all.
Particularly any longer.
Nope.
The data analyzed shows that income inequality is measured by the proportion of income taken by the top 1% of earners reached a modern high just before the recession hit in 2009. But the wealthy have snapped back, the poor haven't. This is not true, the snapback to the 2007 peak. It's not true for average working families. After accounting for inflation, median family income has declined over the last 2 years. In 2011, a lot of these conservatives want to attribute this to people's work habits or that they don't have enough ambition.
Oh, no. They say those lazy poor people. Yeah. Let's be real. That's what they say.
But this is all of us. This has to do with all of us, that the median family income has declined for the last 2 years. And this is because the wages have been driven down. They didn't fall down like by themselves. They were driven down.
Yeah, there's a big difference.
Who drove them down, and what would be the purpose of driving them down? I mean, do I have to say this? I mean, it's the people that have the financial positioning that they can determine what other people's wages consist of, and they do it because they're thieves. They're looters.
Yeah.
They steal people's lives. They enforce people into a life of penury.
It's easy for them.
Which is poverty. I didn't misspeak myself. Okay. That's another word.
Okay.
It is getting late. In fact, late enough, we probably should begin to say goodbye, huh?
Yes, we should.
Goodbye.
We want to get out of before the top of the hour and when your interviews start. Thank you to John.
Yeah. Go to
for taking our calls and being a great producer.
Check my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Our Facebook page, which you can link from there. Just look at the
podcast Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Tomorrow is President's Day. Today.
Yeah. So happy President's Day. And so we salute Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan.
George
W. And Fillmore M. somebody or other. Good grief. All right, folks, next week. Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. The domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell is dedicated to leveling the playing field for men in divorce and now is offering complimentary 30-minute initial consultations. Men choose Cordell & Cordell because they want to feel that their interests and the interests of their children are aggressively championed. Everyone involved in a divorce is affected by the breakup of the family. Cordell & Cordell seeks to help you through this difficult time and to ensure your rights are protected so you can move on with your life. If you're a man confronted with a marriage you can't save, you should consider Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. To schedule your complimentary 30-minute initial consultation, please call 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in Ann Arbor, Novi, and Troy.
Honey, why you calling me so late? It's kind of hard to talk right now. Honey, why you crying? Is everything okay? I gotta whisper cause I can't be too loud. Oh well, my girl's in the next room. Sometimes I wish she was you. I guess we never really moved on. It's really good to hear your voice. Say my name, it sounds so sweet. Coming from the lips of an angel. Hearing those words, it makes me weak. Living alone, never want to say.
Yes.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
The 2013 Riff Rock Girl Search begins soon. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, to many of you listening, when we start talking about the war in Vietnam, it could be like World War II or maybe the Spanish-American War or something like that, because I suspect maybe even the majority of you were born after the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. Yet there's so much about it that resonates today, everything from military tactics to politics. And someone who's been on this broadcast any number of times before recently took a trip to Vietnam, now a united Vietnam, North and South Vietnam. His name is Frank Joyce. He's an old friend of mine. He's worn so many hats during a long and distinguished career in both professionally and in the peace and social justice movement. And he was the organizer of a delegation that went back just recently to Vietnam. And I stress went back because 43 years ago, Frank Joyce also toured Vietnam. And I should say probably the most important designation, an old and dear friend. Frank Joyce, welcome back.
Peter, great, always great to be here.
Yeah, so this is unusual. I mean, sometimes we get GIs that have been going back to Vietnam, but people that were active in the anti-war movement, not the people that fought, that's a little bit unusual. Tell us about it.
Well, we called ourselves the peace veterans, as a matter of fact, and many U.S. soldiers who fought in Vietnam have been back to Vietnam, and we'll probably talk about that some more. But the premise of this delegation was that I was approached some time ago by a scholar at the University of at McAllister College, who said, "I want you to work with me on a book about people who went to North Vietnam during the war."
Mm-hmm.
And she happened to know that I was a person who did that in the spring of 1970. The most famous person, of course, who went to Vietnam during the war was Jane Fonda.
And the first, reviled for
it. Yes, reviled for it and paid a very heavy price for it throughout the course of her career. The first group of people who went to Vietnam during the war in 1965 was Tom Hayden, Herbert Aptheker, and Staunton Lind. And they were followed by a series of delegations that continued basically from 1965 through 1975, who went to Hanoi and other places in North Vietnam. In conjunction with starting to work on this book, I said, well, let's put a trip together and let's see who of the group of people who did this, which turned out to be a much larger group than I had even realized, maybe as many as, certainly more than 100 people, peace activists from the United States, went to Vietnam during the war. We wound up with nine of us, who we came to call ourselves the Hanoi Nine in the course of the trip. Probably the best known of the nine of us was Rennie Davis, who was one of the defendants in a famous case called the Chicago Eight. And another person who I think you know of, Peter, if you don't know, is Judy Gumbo Albert,
sure,
who was the widow of Stu Albert. And she and Nancy Kershan were among the founders of the Yippies, who was the Youth International Peace Party, most notably associated with it, with the late Abby Hoffman. Anyway, it was a fascinating group of the nine of us, very representative of different experiences during war, different strains of the anti-war movement, etc. And then, together with spouses and some scholars and a filmmaker, we were a total delegation of 15 people.
Well, Frank Joyce, let's look a little bit at the politics of it, both then and now. As you said, that Jane Fonda continues to suffer criticism for her trip there and some of the acts that she, I guess, even later apologized for. But it could occur to the listener, or maybe to most listeners, why in the world would people who want peace go to the area in which the enemy of the United States resides? And isn't that traitorous? In fact, I remember there's a vets bar that you know of, and a lot of famous musicians have played there. The Old Miami, which
sure.
And they, I remember, had a bumper sticker, "Traitor Bitch Jane Fonda." I mean, the kind of, you know, this was aid and comfort to the enemy. What brought you and others between 1965 and 1975 and you in 1970, and what are the political implications of visiting a, quote, enemy land?
Well, it was very powerful to be there then. The short answer to your question, Peter, is that I didn't think the Vietnam government or the Vietnamese people were the enemy of the United States. I thought my own government was, because I thought the war was illegitimate to begin with. It didn't have a valid purpose, and the tactics that were being used to wage the war, I thought, and many other anti-war and peace activists at the time, were so reprehensible and so disproportionate to any legitimate cause that there might have been, that we wanted to make a statement, and we wanted to let the Vietnamese know that while the government might be waging war on them, the people of the United States were not united in support of the Vietnam War. They were not when the war initially began, and the date of that is an interesting issue in and of itself. But as you know, and partly because of the draft and partly for a variety of reasons, as the war went on and on and on, and as the casualties went up and up and up on both sides, 55,000 U.S. soldiers were killed in Vietnam in the course of this action. And for what? We didn't think the purpose was legitimate, we wanted to, as I say, make a statement on behalf of many, many Americans of all ages and really of all political persuasions that we did not support the war.
One of the things that the social critic Noam Chomsky poses to people that aren't real familiar with the details of the Vietnam War is to ask, how many civilians do you think died at the hands of the American war machine? And he said usually people just kind of draw a blank, and sometimes they'll offer 200,000, 300,000, something like that. And he compares it to a German giving a figure like that during, being asked about the Holocaust. And it was a Holocaust for the Indochinese. The figures are so large that it's an estimate, if you could imagine it. What is it, like 2 to 3 million, depending on who you are asking?
Well, let me tell you two incidents from this trip on that score.
Let me just say, if you're joining us, and I'm remiss at that, but I don't want to stick with history. Frank Joyce is my guest, and he recently organized a delegation of people who had formerly visited Vietnam 40 years ago, and he's returned, and he's telling us about his trip. I'm sorry, Frank. Go ahead.
Sure. Here are two really powerful experiences from this trip, which I'm just back from a few days, as a matter of fact. Part of the purpose and the timing of the trip was to observe the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, and that happened on the 27th of January, 1973. And that was basically the beginning of the United States disengagement and withdrawal of troops and so on and so forth from Vietnam and ultimately from Cambodia and Laos as well. This anniversary was a very big deal in Vietnam, and you were here in the United States. I don't think there was one single news story in one single newspaper about something that was really quite significant and was a very big deal at the time. And for those who were old enough to remember Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and how significant it was that the United States had signed this peace treaty, which was essentially the cover that the United States used to say, we've devoted all these lives and inflicted all this damage and spent all this money, and we have nothing to show for it. We have lost this war. Well, the notion of having lost the war is, of course, a part of the legacy of Vietnam, etc. One of the observances of this 40th anniversary took place in Hanoi on the 23rd of January in the main concert hall, if you will, of downtown Hanoi, a very lovely, modern, up-to-date building. It was attended by 1,000 people. The president of Vietnam spoke. Madam Nguyen Thi Binh, who some people will remember as the woman who was the negotiator for the South Vietnamese in the Paris peace talks that led up to this agreement, spoke and was honored. And we and some other peace activists who were also in Hanoi for this event were given a police escort through the streets of Hanoi, arrived at this ceremony, walked up a red carpet past an honor guard with a military band playing John Philip Sousa songs.
And you guys were probably wearing Levi's.
No, we were dressed up.
Oh,
we're just
okay. All right.
We wouldn't have been maybe 40 years ago, but we were at this time. It was an extraordinary experience to be acknowledged as having contributed to something valuable and important. And I would argue today, and do argue today, that when the 50th, Barack Obama is talking about, you know, 50 years of war in Vietnam, it's actually much, many more years than that. 1975 and 2015 will be the actual end of the war on April 30th. There'll be a lot of attention paid to the military in the course of all of this. What there should be attention paid to is the role of the peace movement in bringing the war to an end.
Yeah, indeed. Frank Joyce is my guest. He's recently returned with a number of other people as a delegation to Vietnam at and returnees, people that had visited there. As Frank did in 1970 and throughout that era. Yeah, the idea at that time, back to beginning quite a bit before that, in the early 1960s, was to stop the march of communism. That you know, it was seen as a clear and present danger. And many people, and this now this has to do with your impressions of the country between 1970 and today, that people have said that capitalism has won. I saw some photographs recently from a friend who has a Vietnamese wife, and I somehow thought that, I think these were from Saigon, and I thought that they would still look like French colonial architecture, and it looked like Abu Dhabi. I mean, it just these incredible modern cities. And he wrote that that the Americans needn't have worried that capitalism won.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to finish one story from this ceremony
that
I think helps to put this in context and helps to address that question as well. So we're leaving this ceremony, which was very powerful and very emotional for everybody who was there, for the Vietnamese, for there were peace activists from all over the world there, from Spain, from Italy, from France, from Venezuela, etc. A very powerful and moving ceremony. As we're leaving, just kind of by accident, I got into a conversation with a guy who turned out to be a colonel in the Vietnamese army. He was in full military regalia. For all I know about the military dress, he could have been a 12-star general, but it turned out he was a colonel. And we got in a conversation, and he said that he had been interviewed recently by, you know, somebody doing a story about the 40th anniversary. And he said the question he had been asked was, how did Vietnam defeat the United States? And his answer was to say, that's the wrong question. Vietnam did not defeat the United States. How could Vietnam defeat the United States, a nation that has 6,000 nuclear weapons and the biggest military arsenal in the history of the world? What Vietnam did was defend our country. I think that's a very interesting way to think about the whole thing. In a way, I hadn't thought about it before, despite decades of being an activist on this question. Another note on that before I come back to this. One of the places that we visited in the course of this trip is a very well-known to American veterans of the war called the Chu Chi Tunnels, which are very near Saigon, and which were an elaborate network of tunnels that were used by the Vietnamese military to both hide from the United States, to be in a position to commit surprise guerrilla raids and so on. One of the people on our delegation, as we were, it's a very impressive military achievement and accomplishment how they were able to construct these tunnels, some of which went directly under U.S. military bases. Anyway, someone in our group said, and this is a tourist destination in Vietnam, by the way. People from all over the world come to see these tunnels because they're just a work of military art, if nothing else. Somebody in our delegation said, "So now I see how the Vietnamese won the war." And our guide, who obviously was born after the war had ended, who is very cheerful, friendly, very interesting guy, got a very serious look on his face and said, "No one won this war. We lost 3,300,000 people in this war. No way can you call that a victory."
There's the figure we were talking about.
There's
earlier.
The figure we were talking about before. The war is still continuing in Vietnam and in Cambodia and Laos, and I would argue it's still continuing in the United States as well. In this way, we visited at least two special schools in Vietnam and a couple of other facilities that are now dealing with the third generation of Vietnamese children who are suffering birth defects and deformities as a result of Agent Orange, which with the United States blanketed Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam with the toxic chemical dioxin, which causes birth defects and which is still the subject of massive cleanup efforts throughout all of Indochina.
This was done to defoliate, as they called it, the countryside, so there wouldn't be any way.
No place to hide.
No place to hide. All the trees would be killed. And it was ecocide, as well as, chemical warfare.
That's exactly right. When we hear people say, Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons, the United States used chemical weapons, including napalm in Vietnam on a scale which probably, hopefully, will never be equaled again and certainly had never been used prior to that. But that's not the whole part of that story either. In addition to that, in all three of these countries, there are, and it's usually children or elderly people, hundreds of people a year who are killed or maimed by unexploded ordnance. In Cambodia alone, the United States dropped more bomb tonnage than was dropped by all combatants in World War II combined.
Wow.
And this ordnance still, it's landmines, it's cluster bombs, it's all sorts of ordnance, and you still can, you can be a kid out playing in a field, particularly in a rural area, and step on a landmine and be killed. And this still happens on a regular basis virtually every day somewhere in Indochina.
Frank Joyce is my guest. He was the organizer of a delegation that returned to Vietnam after 40 years plus. And sometimes I have to admit, dear listener, that I'm at a loss to what question to ask next of a guest. This has got to be a four-hour interview compressed into 25 minutes with about 7 minutes left of it. So you were there in 1970. Were there places that you had previously visited and could compare
Absolutely. And that gets us in part to the question that you did ask that I haven't answered yet,
right,
Peter, and I haven't forgotten.
Didn't capitalism win after all? Yeah.
Well, in a certain sense, capitalism did win in the sense that the term that's used, and I don't want to get off in a long conversation of this, it's quite complicated in my view, but the term that's used is a market-based socialism.
Right.
I'd been back to Vietnam on a previous trip. There's a Ford factory in Vietnam. One of the places that we visited on this trip was a fascinating place called Garment Factory Number 10.
Ooh.
Let me tell you a little bit about Garment Factory Number 10. There are 10 garment manufacturing facilities that are run by this company throughout Vietnam. They have plants near Saigon, near Hanoi, etc. The place we visited was the home factory and the world and the Vietnam headquarters of this organization. It started making military uniforms. This factory made uniforms for Ho Chi Minh, and that is part of their story. Now they make clothing for Walmart, for JCPenney, etc. But they are not the kind of sweatshop that we associate with garment factories in Bangladesh or China or whatever. They're two-thirds employee-owned. They have an in-house daycare center for the workers. They have an in-house medical clinic for the workers. They pay three times the minimum wage in Vietnam. And so capitalism, in a way, but is it the kind of capitalism that you see in Bangladesh? No, it's not. It's capitalism of a nation that has fought for its own independence and that has had the leadership of people of the quality of Ho Chi Minh, who's a very different figure than Mao or Stalin or any of the people that we associate with communist brutality. And so, yes, there are foreign investors, and there is a stock exchange, and there are some of the, you know, the mechanics of what we think of as capitalism in Vietnam. Some of it looks the same. None of it really is completely the same.
I asked you, Frank Joyce, whether you had been to the same places, and I was wondering what kind of emotions. I mean, you, when these veterans of the American military go back, they're often, because their circumstances there in the 40 and 45 years ago was a lot different. They're overcome with emotion. Did you feel any of that? Did any of the people there, or was it,
Yes, there were very powerful moments, including at this ceremony of the 40th anniversary, and especially when we were in sessions with young children who were in these special schools for victims of Agent Orange and unexploded ordnance and so on and so forth. It so happened that when I was in Vietnam in 1970, I was there on the day four students were killed at Kent State University in Ohio. Hmm. And I remember being told by the Vietnamese we were with at the time that this had happened and how deeply moved they were by the fact that there had been these casualties, and there were also students killed at Jackson State at the time, of people who were struggling for peace and social justice in the United States. We also met with victims of U.S. torture. When people talk about Abu Ghraib and torture in Iraq, the United States didn't start to practice torture, in Iraq. The United States practiced extensive torture throughout Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos during this war. And I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about a new book called Kill Anything That Moves by Nick Terse.
Who I just interviewed. Let me interrupt you, and this is kind of a sad note to end things on, but we have exactly 2 minutes left. And so you and others went to Vietnam, revisiting it after closing in on half a century. And was it a trip of solely of nostalgia, or is there something that you can bring back that says something about today as well?
That's a great question, Peter, and I'm glad you asked me that. It's a trip that makes you sad. It's a trip that makes you realize the moral bankruptcy of American foreign policy. It's a trip that reminds you that we're no spring chickens here, Peter. You know, you realize the United States has been at war with somebody all of our lives.
That's right.
Continuously. This is not normal national behavior. Other nations do not go to war at the drop of a hat and stay at war as a part of their national economy and their national culture. And we need to think about that.
Well, there was in Europe, of course, the Hundred Years' War, which literally destroyed the physical and cultural and emotional fabric of that
And we
area.
Pay a price here, too. Yeah. Two quick things. I hope we have time. One of the places we visited, some areas were more contaminated by Agent Orange than others. In particular, the places where Agent Orange was staged, where it was offloaded, etc. These are called hot spots, and three of them are currently being cleaned up, which is a very difficult and dangerous thing to do. Many of the contractors who were working on these cleanup sites, and we had great conversations with them, were Vietnam veterans of the war.
Huh. Well, they're, you know, when it all, when the human participants, the American military veterans and the veterans of the anti-war and peace movement, like Frank Joyce and myself, look at it. I mean, hopefully it comes into a perspective that makes some sense. Frank Joyce, as usual, I want to thank you for being on the broadcast. I'm just sorry we don't have that other 3.5 hours to talk more about this. But Vietnam is...
There'll be a book and maybe a movie, Peter. Okay. That's part of the idea of it.
And and Vietnam is a lens through which we can look at things today. Frank Joyce, thanks for being on my show.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Yeah, I do a lot on history, and it's not because I'm just a history buff. In fact, I'm not at all. I find history fascinating because, you know, the old adage about if we don't learn from history, we will repeat it. And, of course, we keep repeating history over and over and over again, often in the negative. So when we talk about something that happened a decade ago or 100 years ago, 150 years ago, it's because it resonates with what is happening today. Now, what the book we're going to talk about, this is not... being replicated exactly today, but it has some bearing on how we approach the freedom of speech. This is enshrined in the First Amendment, so we all think, oh, what makes our country great? It has freedom of speech. Well, oftentimes in American history, the right of free speech has come under terrific assault. And a subcategory that is academic freedom, the right of university professors to say what they believe in interpreting their subjects, the right of the lower grades to also be able to talk in a way that to be free of government supervision and certainly free of government repression. Well, I think, as most of you know, that was violated greatly during the 1950s when they had, it was either called the McCarthy era, the era of the Red Scare, or also an anti-communist purge. There was an effort afoot to rid our nation's schools of those who the people in power felt jeopardized the country because they had allegiance not to the United States and the freedoms for which it stood, but rather to the communist enemy. And the book is Priests of Our Democracy. The subtitle is The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. The author is Marjorie Hines, and Marjorie Hines is a civil liberties lawyer. She's a writer and teacher and the founding director of Free Expression Policy Project. And her previous book, Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth, has won an American Library Association award, and she's had other books as well, including Sex, Sin, and Blasphemy, A Guide to America's Censorship Wars, several other books as well. We are reaching her in her office in New York City. Marjorie Hines, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter.
So we're talking about a period now over half a century ago, and it almost seems quaint now that because pretty much now everybody says, oh, you know, you can almost say you're anything and not get, at least in New York City and here in Detroit, and not get too much flack. But tell us about the teachers and the university professors in the period of the anti-communist purges and the Red Scare.
Well, as you mentioned, this was a period in history where people in the United States were using well-justified fears of communist expansion abroad to attack communists in the United States, anybody who may have once been one in the 1930s when the party was quite popular. And so it was an across-the-board assault. Our loyalty programs were established in numerous industries and professions, Hollywood being one of the most celebrated.
But before you go, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but, you know, you went over real quickly. I'm not sure everybody knows. You said loyalty oath. So just quickly tell us what was demanded of people.
Okay, well, loyalty oaths have a long history in the United States, and there's basically two kinds. There's the kind we still have a lot of, which is I promise to support and defend the Constitution, the affirmative oath, and then there's the negative oath, which was used so widely during the McCarthy era, to basically either intimidate people into a kind of ceremonial assertion of patriotism and loyalty, or drive people out of professions, including especially teaching, because they objected to or couldn't, whether they objected because they were Jehovah's Witnesses or Quakers, or whether they objected because on conscious grounds, or whether they had actually once been or maybe still were communists. The negative oaths were generally phrased as, I'm not now and ever have been a member of the Communist Party or any organization that believes in the overthrow of the government, and if I ever was, I'm going to tell the boss about it. And what that usually entailed eventually was being called before an investigating committee of Congress or a state legislature, being told by your boss you had to go talk to the FBI and name names of everybody you knew who had signed a petition or was at a meeting which was communist-sponsored. So it was a very broad kind of inquisition. But the oaths were a method of enforcing these broader loyalty programs.
Well, Marjorie Hines, there was the feeling, and the political sense at the time, that not only was there a danger from communist expansionism abroad, but also that that the people that were sympathetic to communism, or let alone members of the Communist Party, actually represented a clear and present danger, and we did not want them teaching our kids. We did not want them putting forth communist ideas in films and what have you. So there was a the Senator McCarthy's committee and in the Senate, and then there was also the House Un-American Activities Committee that tried to ferret out those that were disloyal. Was this a real danger, or the other phrase I didn't use was anti-communist hysteria? That actually, that the fright was way exaggerated from the actual danger.
You're right. It was wildly exaggerated, which isn't to say that the Communist Party made a lot of mistakes, and the worst one was its long-standing adherence to the party line, which was whatever Stalin and the Soviet Union decided was in their interest in appropriate time, at a particular time. So you do have a history of, at the same time that people are joining the Communist Party in the 30s, because it is the most dynamic organization around, and it is fighting race discrimination and like no one else is, and it is advocating for the rights of the unemployed and organized labor and lots of good causes. At the same time, the party leadership is doctrinaire, dictatorial, and following a line from Moscow that is not in anybody's interest in the United States. Did that amount to disloyalty? If it was only a question of your political position, were you for or against the Nazi-Soviet pact? Were you for or against fascism? No, it did not present a threat to the security of the United States. There was espionage. There was a small number of communists who were engaged in spying. That was clearly a threat. It was not ever as big a threat as it was made out to be during the McCarthy era. But it's a mixed history. I mean, a lot of people who are historians in this area talk about the history of the American left, and especially the Communist Party, which was became dominant in the 30s in the leadership of the left, that it's really a tragic history, because mm-hmm. so many good and well-intentioned people who were angry about injustice, angry about the exploitation of workers, wanted to do something about racism, were drawn into the communist movement, and it was incredibly compromised, and that left it quite vulnerable to the Red Hunt of the 50s. But the bottom line is the domestic threat of subversion was greatly exaggerated, and it was used by opportunistic politicians to do everything from attack the Truman administration and certainly the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt to attack the civil rights movement and to drive people out of professions and jobs, including teaching, who had never been accused of and never were guilty of any sort of indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were driving out kindergarten teachers. They were driving out math teachers. So it was a very broad period of political repression.
My guest is Marjorie Hines. Her book is, her latest book is Priests of Our Democracy, the Supreme Court, Academic Freedom and the Anti-Communist Purge. And we're talking about particularly about the era of the 1950s, and in specifically in New York City. Tell us, who are the priests of our democracy? Who are the priests in the title of your book?
The priests, some people in looking at the title think, oh, is she talking about the Supreme Court justices? But in fact, it's a quote from a Supreme Court decision, which recognizes academic freedom and talks about teachers as the priests of our democracy, because not because they're specially smart or deserve any special privileges, but because they're the ones who perform the function for all of society of, and I'm quoting from the court opinion, they foster those habits of open-mindedness and critical inquiry, which alone make for responsible citizens. So that may be sort of idealistic, and not all teachers perform that job as well as others, but what it is grounded in is a philosophy of education, that it's not just about rote learning, it's not just about pledging allegiance and memorizing dates and believing that your country did no wrong, but it really is about a process of learning how to think and to analyze information and to be intelligent participants in democracy. So it's their role in keeping our democracy functioning that makes them priests of our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie Hines, take us back to the 1950s, and we're talking about, as you mentioned, how the teachers, kindergarten teachers through university professors, became under attack for their beliefs or their previous or at the time current associations, maybe even either a broad description or even using specific examples of what teachers in New York faced in the 1950s.
Well, you know, the one reason that a lot of the book takes place in New York is that it started out, I was an ACLU lawyer. I was interested in First Amendment academic freedom cases and how they arose out of the political repression of the 50s. And as I began to look into the political history and the human history of the people who were involved in these cases, it turned out a lot of them came from New York. Both city and state, but especially New York City, because what you had here was a very active and strong radical left movement going back to the early part of the 20th century, and also a lot of reaction and repression, so that by the 1930s you have fascism in the United States is very alive and well in New York City. The Christian Front and other anti-Semitic fascist groups are having rallies and intimidating people in Jewish neighborhoods, and you also still have a very active left. And the New York Teachers Union in the 1930s and 40s and well through the 50s is a radical left-wing union, and of course it gets accused of being communist run. There were certainly lots of dedicated communists who were often the most active working on advocating for better school conditions, advocating against racism in textbooks. I mean, there's some really appalling examples of racism in the textbooks that we used in the New York City schools well into the 1950s. One that I quote in the book is a history textbook which told the students that slavery was a happy life. I'm quoting, I'm not exaggerating, because the slaves only had to think about doing their work well. They were well taken care of. So that kind of racism, the teachers' union is fighting against, and they're not making a lot of friends in the bureaucracy of the New York Board of Education. So when, after World War II ends and the Cold War begins, and fear of communist expansion in Europe gets translated into really hysterical, exaggerated fear of communist subversion in the U.S. The New York City Board of Education takes advantage of this atmosphere and undertakes a process of investigating and interrogating teachers, elementary, high school teachers, some staff throughout the city school system. And guess what? Most of them are leaders of the teachers' union.
Hmm.
So it's a very convenient way to bust this union. And the union, remarkably, hangs on for more than 10 years after, in 1950, the New York City Board of Education decides they're going to completely blacklist the teachers' union on the accusation that they have communists in their leadership. And they're not going to be allowed to have meetings in the city schools, represent any teacher in negotiations of a personnel issue before the board. So they're really making very aggressive efforts to wipe out this union. And one of the other methods that they're using is targeting the leaders, calling them in for questioning, asking them about their political beliefs, activities, associations, everything from whether you signed a petition in support of the Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War, to whether you marched in a May Day parade, to whether you went to a Paul Robeson concert, Paul Robeson having been a prominent left-wing African-American, an incredibly talented singer and actor.
What would happen, like, for instance, if my employer now started saying to me, I would say, you know what, that's none of your business. What would happen if they refused to answer the questions? One can only imagine.
You know, if it's a government employer, you might have some protection from that kind of inquisition. If it's a private employer, the First Amendment's not going to protect you. Maybe you'd have a union or some contract right. But these teachers who were called up in the late 40s and early 50s by the New York City Board of Education said exactly that. And interestingly, the city went forward on charges to fire them, not on grounds that they were or ever had been communists or had done anything improper ever in the classroom, but that they were insubordinate for refusing to answer the question.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So they are fired for insubordination and conduct unbecoming.
How many are we talking about here that were actually dismissed from the New York school system?
The numbers are hard to get, but the historians are generally agreeing around 33. At least there were 33 who were years later reinstated. Most of them were retirement age by that time, given their pensions.
Hundreds. Yeah. Okay, good. That's what I was going to, because I was going to say, on the face of it, you go, whoa, wait a minute. That's pretty awful. One would be awful, but 33 doesn't seem to be, go ahead. You used the word hundreds. I want
to
hear.
Doesn't seem to be as massive as it was in some industries. There were hundreds who either did not have full contract rights. They might have been probationary, or the city had a practice of not giving people in the school system permanent tenured positions. So lots of people could be dismissed without any proceedings at all. Lots of people, when called before these interrogators, resigned or retired rather than go through a process whose end, after the first set of eight were fired, they knew perfectly well what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. If they didn't want to answer the questions, which also included naming names of others who'd been at a meeting or joined in a campaign, they were going to have to name names. If they didn't want to go that route, they resigned. So there were several hundred in the New York City school system, and you can multiply that all over the country.
Sure, because I know it happened in Detroit as well. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Marjorie Hines. She's written Priest of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. And you can go to her website that has the book and lots of other organization, and tell me if I've got this right. It's FEPproject.org?
That's right.
FrankEdwardPeterProject.org. There'll also be a link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. You can pick it up at either place. We're talking about the era of the 1950s called the McCarthy era, the era of communist hysteria when academia was under heavy assault by officialdom, who said that there were all these communists teaching communist ideas in the public schools and in the universities. Now it occurs to me that this also was a convenient way to attack labor unions, as it was, and going way to the right of communist ideas, liberal ideas in general. I think you mentioned one of them, civil rights.
Yeah, it was certainly used by opportunistic politicians and freelance right-wing advocates and lobbyists to go after a variety of what we would now consider liberal, progressive, reform movements. And certainly Martin Luther King and the entire civil rights movement were accused of being communist. So it was certainly a convenient bit of ammunition in the American political debate.
You know, I'm just looking at the clock again. I can't believe how fast interesting interviews go by. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to get to this one item in your subtitle from The Priest of Our Democracy, and that's the Supreme Court. So we people were fired here in Michigan and in the Detroit school system, and your book concentrates mostly on New York. How did the Supreme Court figure in this finally?
Well, actually, one reason a lot of the human story takes place in New York is that a number of the important Supreme Court decisions came out of New York. And as I said, New York both had a radical left tradition and a tradition of reaction and red baiting. So the first case that gets up to the Supreme Court from New York is, in fact, a challenge to a state law, which was really modeled on the Truman administration's federal employee loyalty program, and it required extensive loyalty investigation of every public employee in the state, including teachers. And it was New York City teachers who challenged the law along with taxpayers. It gets to the Supreme Court in 1952, and the Supreme Court upholds the law, basically relying on an old and now much discredited notion that you may have a right to free speech, but you have no right to a job. And therefore, presumably, any kind of condition on public employment, any kind of questioning, any kind of relinquishment of constitutional rights is fair game. So
that must have had a chilling effect, for sure, because essentially you can do this.
It gave the green light to loyalty programs for public employees. That by 1952, the Supreme Court has already upheld an anti-communist oath that's required of labor union leaders in order to take advantage of the National Labor Relations Act and collective bargaining. So labor union, anybody who couldn't sign that oath or objected was driven out of labor union leadership. So the court had already upheld a number of measures. And over the dissent, predictable and consistent, of two justices, William O. Douglas and Hugo Black. And Douglas's dissent in particular in this New York case called Adler versus Board of Education has all this really prescient, prophetic language about what a loyalty program like this is going to do to the school system. It's going to turn the school system into a spying project. Teachers are going to be looking over their shoulder. Students are going to be informing on teachers. Teachers are going to be informing on each other. What was the relevance of the history teacher's reference to the fascists in Spain? What was the relevance of the history of the English teacher's approval of the novel *The Grapes of Wrath* by John Steinbeck?
You know, let's do this. We're almost out of time. Tell me, but how did this finally get concluded? Was there at any point that this was seen to be a violation of the First Amendment?
Well, eventually, the same law in New York State that gets upheld in the 1952 case over the dissent by Douglas gets struck down in 1967. In a decision called Kayishian versus Board of Regents. Interestingly, the lead plaintiff, Harry Kayishian, had been a student in the 50s in the New York City colleges, and got politicized by watching some of the best professors at his college being summarily fired for refusing to cooperate with investigating committees. So he gets to the University of Buffalo as a young professor in the early 60s, and this law is still on the books, and he and a few other professors challenge it and gets to the Supreme Court in 67. The Supreme Court strikes down the New York loyalty law and reverses that 1952 decision and says basically these kinds of loyalty programs, they're too broad, they suppress free speech, and they rely on guilt by association.
Sure. Well, that's good to know for sure. In a minute, relevance for today, or is this just interesting history?
It's relevant for today. I mean, anti-terrorism is not exactly the new anti-communism, but it has some similarities because the definitions vary and the term is scary, and it tends to be waved around in order to justify all kinds of repressive initiatives by the government that that go far beyond any realistic attempt to protect our country from another 9/11.
I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. My guest has been Marjorie Hines. Her new book is Priest of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court Academic Freedom and the Anti-Communist Purge, referring to the 1950s. You can go to her website, fepproject.org, and information about her book or other books as well, and the project itself. You can see also a link at my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Marjorie Hines, thanks for being on the broadcast.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money, which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click bam boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click bam boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
RIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
It's going to work great because it'll make you run.
Everything that rocks.